Okay, let's call this committee meeting to order on March 13th here in the Local Government Division. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for attending. And then, Representative Biffkin, would you like to move the first bill here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1189. We recommend pass and be referred to the Committee on Government.
Okay. Well, so I guess we'll change the order. Maybe I should go through the order here. I know from our seat here. So today what we're going to do is we're going to start with Senate File 104, presented by Representative Kelly.
Yep.
And then second in the order will be House File 940 by Representative Zellers. And then we're going to start the way it is on our the minutes here on the agenda with Representative Torkelson's bill, me, and then Representative Roods, and then finish with Representative Bryan's bill.
So, Mr. Chair, I withdraw my previous motion.
Okay. All right.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 104 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations.
All right. Thank you, Representative Biffkin. Welcome, Representative Kelly, and if you can go with your testimony with Bill, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kelly, along with Glenn Weibel, who's a former mayor of Cannon Falls, and we're here maybe for something exciting. We'd actually like to save some tax dollars across the state here, so I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I will let Mr. Weibel take it from here.
Okay, thanks, Representative Kelly. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. When I walked in today, about a half hour ago, a representative asked me, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm not here to ask for money." He said, "You must be in the wrong place." But what we are here for, I'm representing the city of Cannon Falls. I am not a city official anymore. I am not a consultant. I am not an engineer. I'm a taxpayer. But while I was mayor, it became apparent in some projects that the city wanted to move forward on, I thought we had some authority to use local contractors and keep our costs down. Our legal counsel advised us we did not have authority, that authority called design and build. What we're experiencing, because we do not have that authority, costs of projects are anywhere from 17% to 22% higher because of architectural fees. And when you're looking at a $2 or $3 million project for a small city, it's very difficult, particularly in these economic times, to make the justification to get those projects done. Specifically, the projects that were affected in Cannon Falls were the proposed library and a proposed fire hall extension. Both of those projects, a high amount of dollars, but both of them projects have been put on the side, one, because of economic conditions, and two, because of the money it costs to have somebody draw pictures that they later take those pictures, put them in a nice folder, and sell them to somebody else for more pictures to be drawn. I really feel that the city, because we have adopted the state building codes, the contractors in the city are licensed by the state, they have to meet the codes. Why we can't have the design and build process for these projects to help us save money. Our current tax capacity right now in Cannon Falls is 124, down a little bit from last year, but we are actively pursuing industry and businesses in a down economy. But even in the interim, the amount of dollars that can be saved, and I'm sure there are other communities who are fighting the same dollar challenge, but the design and build will absolutely assist us. Now, in the Senate, they have passed this, and I would request your attention to the request and ask for your support to pass this on so that the city of Cannon Falls can continue making plans. Right now, because of costs, because of the economy, it is on hold, very honestly, but by using five or six different local contractors who we tell them what we want in the building and let them draw it, we get five or six different concepts, saving 20%. And that seems to be an advantage not only for the local economy, but also for the local taxpayer to achieve a quality product at a reasonable price that they can afford.
Thank you. Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kelly, Mr. Rybel, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Just a little bit of background for you. I actually carried a bill last year, Representative Kelly, that in response to the 35W bridge contract process, that is probably the most visible use of design build. In the end, we got the bill passed the House, but not on the second to last day, I believe, and then the Senate ran out of time. My concern, and I think that it was in response to the public's concern about the design build process and the lack of transparency and the ability for seemingly arbitrary decisions to be made about who gets selected and why. As you know, the criteria are much more flexible. I think that flexibility, as you just spoke to, Mr. Rybel, is really important. And the department, MnDOT, especially Commissioner Sorrell, has been very forthcoming in addressing the transparency of the process during the technical scoring and the other review qualifications. That is not yet embodied in rule or statute. It's a kind of informal agreement that we have with the department. My concern is, and actually, Mr. Rybel, the very things that you just talked about local contractors and other pieces, is exactly what we were after, one of the things that we were after in addition to transparency in the 35W changes. Because we want the city of Cannon Falls, we want MnDOT, we want the state to be able to very clearly articulate to project proposers as well as to the public why decisions are made during that process. I'm just uncomfortable proceeding with expanding the ability to use design build without having those guarantees, 10 items in statute or in the bill, and I don't see them in the bill currently. I'm also a little bit concerned for the city of Cannon Falls that the litigative process that we've seen with the 35W bridge, it was a very controversial project, not only because of the incident, but also the scope, that the process can be open to more litigation because of the much greater flexibility that local governments have through the process. So I'm wondering if you could address kind of your feelings about the exposure to litigation, and perhaps if Ms. Dyson might be able to tell us generally whether the local authority that the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission and Hennepin County have to use design build, whether that tracks very closely with the existing state contracts, because I'm afraid that they track very closely and that they don't include those guarantees.
Ms. Dyson. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I haven't looked at the state authority, so I can't answer that question at this time. I can look into it for you.
Great. Please do. Thank you.
If I may address the transparency, I think the surroundings of Cannon Falls versus the 35W bridge. In Cannon Falls, if you sneeze, six people give you their handkerchiefs. The fire department has got 30 volunteers. The library is used by X number of patrons. The council's meetings are televised. Planning Commission meetings are made available. The local newspaper is fully involved. Transparency is very, very evident in Cannon Falls. The ability to get the information out on the different proposals. This particular concept has been discussed for the better part of about 8 months prior to approaching the legislature to get the authority and the rationale behind. At no time have we heard any local challenges to the effort. As a matter of fact, we have been encouraged by some of the contractors to pursue it because they would design the buildings. Again, if you have four or five who are licensed to do it, they could bring four or five different concepts. We're having to use an architect and you get one, what his idea is. I think the dollar cost-benefit, and it's a cost-benefit relationship, that you have to look at is what's the city going to get? on a $2 million project, when you're looking at 20 to 22%, that's a sizable amount of money. We have residents, as all small communities in Minnesota have, are losing their homes, their jobs are being lost. As these decisions are made, I think I can sit here and rest assure you, in Cannon Falls, transparency is absolute. We want more transparency, because the more transparency, the more participants you get willingly to put forth their effort, either paid or non-paid, for the betterment of the city.
Representative Caitlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with you. We know that the local elected officials and the city, in some ways, unfortunately, we're actually a little bit insulated here at the Capitol, that the local units of government are often the most easily accessible. But the concern is about the evaluation criteria and the scoring formula. For instance, 15 of the 100 points for the 35W bridge, as established in the RFP, were for essentially, well, what the department termed public relations.
Mm-hmm.
Those 15 points turned out to be worth about $70 million. You'd take a tenth or a hundredth of that for a local project. Design build is really meant to be used to fast track projects where, like the in your neck of the woods, the Hastings Bridge, I think, is a very good example of where design build is going to be an effective use on a state facility. I think that the transparency elements that were in the bill that I carried, and Senator Murphy, interestingly, was the Senate author, and I'm sure that you've talked about this a little bit, that we want to make sure that the criteria by which those scores are developed, I know Representative Hornstein followed the issue last year pretty well as well, that we want to make sure that those criteria are very, very closely tied, and that it's clear that the scoring committee can very clearly articulate to the public why those technical scores were given. That's my concern here, and I'm sorry, Representative Kelly, this is the first chance to interact formally, because I respect what you're trying to do. I just have a lot of questions about the design build process and whether, absent the fix that we've proposed and have been working with the department over a year and a half, absent that actually being put on paper, whether we want to expand the ability to use the process beyond where we are currently.
Representative Kelly, certainly appreciate your experience, and maybe we can draw from that a little bit here. Being that was a transportation and a bridge project, and this being a building project, is there something specific that either you had to add, or other than Section 2 and 3 that specifically lays out the process there, is there anything specific that we could add to this bill to help us with this process?
Representative Caitlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kelly, I think what I'm inclined to do is to pull out the list of 10 principles from last year, and I believe that it's in Section 3, and it's really relative to what needs to be included in the RFP,
mm-hmm.
Where I think we really need to be very explicit about how the criteria, the evaluation criteria and the technical scores are established. So I think, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, what I'd like to do is offer Representative Kelly to pull out and work together, pull out the list that we developed with MnDOT, and see if we can work on this in Chair Pulaski's Government Operations Committee, and address this issue of transparency. I'm still not convinced that we need to that now is the time to expand access to this tool, but I'd like to see if we can find a way to ensure that the public has full access to all the scoring criteria and the way that the formulae are developed.
Mr. Chair,
if I hear you correct, and please correct me if I'm wrong, your concern is in the rewarding of a project, if the public is fully informed of why it's rewarded, what the point system was, how the point number was achieved at, and why the award was taking place in a public forum. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rybo, I think that's half of it, but the other half is, and I'm still trying to square the state process with the proposed local process. In the existing state process, the technical scoring committee is done privately, and the proposals are confidential because the intellectual property of the proposal belongs to the proposer. And Representative Beard might be, I know that you worked on the bill with me last year as well, so correct me if I'm missing something here, but that process is inherently not public unless the losing proposers choose to give up their intellectual property for that proposal. And so it's that inherent nature of the design-build process, that second round, where proposals are really fleshed out and then given and then finally scored technically. That's where the public, I don't think, has the same level of access as they would under a typical design, bid, build, low bid procurement process. And that's where the accountability and transparency pieces that we were working on last year go to, is how much can you flesh out without stepping on the rights of the losing proposers to ensure that they keep the property or they keep the ideas. Some sort of, let's say that there's an innovative door mechanism that they're, you know, that they're designing for a fire hall, or an innovative way that they're dealing with the geometrics of the street. That is there because they've designed it. That's the critical component for me. But I'm happy to continue to work with both you, Mr. Rybo, and Representative Kelly, to see if we can answer those questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Kelly?
And Representative Kelly, I'm just curious, as opposed to, or just looking back at the bridge project, for example, just so that we're on the same page, I believe, do you have any idea what the cost savings was on that project because we were able to go design build?
Representative Taylor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, in the end, it was actually the time scale, the cost per day delay of the, every day the bridge was down was a $400,000 economic impact. The time bonus for the project was $200,000 a day. As most folks who don't follow this issue at all will still remember that we chose the highest bid with the longest schedule. The concern from a lot of us was that when we asked questions of MnDOT whether the winning proposer was able to kind of shoot in the dark and say, look at the formula, okay, here's how we're going to get it. We're going to set up the way that we get the most bonus but go for the highest technical score, that then sorry, I heard Representative Nelson say yeah, because he and I worked on this as well, but the highest technical score, so that then allowed them to go highest price and longest timeline, so then they could get the maximum bonus. In terms of the dollars saved, in that case there was a very critical time component, and I don't know that we that time component is present in this Cannon Falls project.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe what we're looking for is something to put something on the fast track and run it down in 35 days. You're not going to find that in Cannon Falls. The biggest element is the dollar saving. We don't have the money, and as you know, LGAs are being cut, and so it has to be. We'll do it. But what we're trying to do is save where we can, and the current process doesn't allow it. Our hands are tied. So the design and build process, I'm not worried about the time frame. If it takes 6 months, that's fine. But I am concerned about the money it's going to cost us as a taxpayer and how we can cut corners. And this is very evident, one area we can make a substantial saving.
Representative Falsey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rybo and Mayor Rybo, I served on the City Council for many years, so I understand, you know, your frustration, and I understand how open city governments are, and you've worked very hard to do that. A problem that I have with this is cities are very different now. It didn't used to be that people sued cities for not being able to have the same rights as other contractors. And I'm just a little nervous here about the setting of precedent. As I understand it, only the state of Minnesota and Hennepin County are the only ones available, able to use design build, and analysts can tell me if I'm wrong. I don't know that other counties are able to use design build at this time other than Hennepin. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scalzi, that's my understanding, yes.
So what I see happening here is lots of people coming in to want to do the same thing. So once we do something here in local government committee, then Ramsey County could come in, Scott County could come in. I mean, this would kind of open the floodgates. That's what I see happening as it affects this committee, which is what we're looking at, is how it affects local government. And I think to answer to your concern about the RFP process, which is a good process, because you don't want to have to just have one architect come in with one concept. And we did this many times in my city. We would have RFPs for concept approval, not for design build, but for concept. And in that manner, we were able to pick and choose the concept we liked the best without having to attach awarding a contract to it, which was very helpful at that time. And I don't know if that would help you, but I mean, somebody coming in with the best concept may not have the best builder as part of the process, and the city may lose a little control in that process. And there's people who say that the design build process sometimes is a little bit more expensive than the other way, because you don't have the way of choosing the different builders that you might choose after you already have your design. So these are just some things you should consider. I'm just a little hesitant to open the floodgates to allow any city then come in and do design build as you would like to do.
Mr. Chair, in respect to the committee's time, I certainly appreciate the offer of Representative Kalin to work with you on this, and I would look forward to doing that.
Okay, well, probably we should do it then in the interest of time and the work that needs to be done on this bill. Let's lay over the bill for now, and then we'll take it up at a later time.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
All right, thanks, Representative Kalin.
Next bill on the agenda for today is House File 940, Zeller's bill. I see Representative Zeller's is in the room.
Chairman
Zeller's, and I, do you want to explain your bill first, or do you want to put the amendment on first, or?
Sure. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that House File 940 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations.
Thank you. And with that, you have an amendment that you do want to put that on first before you start explaining the bill? Or?
That would be great, Mr. Chairman. I understand. If you accept the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like to present it.
Proceed. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman.
Yes,
I believe we have to vote on that.
Oh, you're right.
A little frazzled here this afternoon. We're running around all day today. All in favor of putting the amendment on, A1 amendments on House File 940, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Amendment adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and hopefully we'll be able to move this one just as quickly as possible as one of your bills just 4 hours ago. It's a technical bill. I have a representative from Hennepin County here to explain the details and stand for any questions you may have.
My name is Luann Lawrence, and I'm Hennepin County Human Resources Manager, and someone who would have been here today but was unable to make it is Matt Nelson from AFSCME, our business representative, who is also supportive of the bill. Hennepin County is governed both by law as well as rules, and we've begun the process of looking at where we can streamline and eliminate duplication. So last year we were able to pass changes to our human resources rules through the Human Resources Board, as well as through the County Board of Commissioners. And some of those rules were also mirrored in the law, so these law changes will enable us to implement those rule changes that have been approved by both of those boards. So the first change is to permit an involuntarily demoted employee who fails probation to be terminated for cause, rather than having them return to the higher level job class that they were unable to perform. The second one is to allow the HR director and the department director to establish the length of the probationary period for a job class. Right now, to change the probationary period requires Human Resources Board approval, so this would help speed up the process for doing that. We would not be looking to exceed 12 months, which is the maximum that has been approved by the Human Resources Board in the past. The third change is to create a panel of three randomly selected department directors to hear alleged non-disciplinary HR rule violations. Those are very rare. They would pertain to things like hiring, hours of work, leaves of absence, etc. And this would also speed up our process by enabling us to convene three department directors as opposed to the Human Resources Board. And then the last one is to allow the county board to directly approve the compensation plan rather than bringing it to the Human Resources Board before it goes to the county board, who is the one who has to approve the funding.
Thank you, Mitch. Florence. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify against or for the bill? How about questions from the members? I just want to state that when I first read this bill, and I am a co-author of it, that I had some concern about the amendment that you put on in the original language there. It just didn't read right to me. The way I read it, and I've been ensured that it's not, and I personally have talked with Matt from AFSCME that they're okay with it. But it just, when I read it, it looked funny to me, so. Mm-hmm. Representative Turner.
Thank you, Chair. I just was wondering on the bill, I see what you're doing with it, but has there been some problems that, other than just being outdated, that you're coming forward with this bill?
It really will help us streamline processes. The Human Resources Board meets periodically, and this would just allow us to be able to go forward more quickly, to be able to meet the needs of our customer departments.
Okay, so more of an efficiency.
Yes. Turner.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions for the members? Then we'll proceed to a vote. All in favor of the bill? Representative Biskin, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 940 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We weren't quite as quick as you, but appreciate your time and have a good weekend.
And then next bill we have on the is House File 1189, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Torkelson, representative from 21B. As this is not only my first bill before this committee, it's my first bill before any committee. So I have brought some treats, and with the chair's approval, we will distribute these to the members of the committee. I'm afraid I don't have enough for the crowd that's behind me, so I apologize.
They don't vote, and somebody has counseled you well that treats are always off.
I have to tell you that I was in my district this morning at a chamber meeting in New Ulm, Minnesota, and these are little bits of strudel that you're getting here this morning, so I hope you enjoy them. I did not taste test them, but they came with high recommendations.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Flanning.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mentioned to Representative Torkelson the other day that it used to be tradition that first-termers had to bring treats whenever they had their first bill before a committee, and somehow along the way that just sort of disappeared as a tradition. So I'm glad to see he brought it back. Since he brought it back, Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 1189 I think the motion is to be recommended to pass and moved on to government operations.
Government operations. Correct. So Representative Lanning moved the bill be, has the bill moved. Representative Torkelson, you want to explain your bill?
Yes, but we also have an A1 amendment that I'd like to add right away, if possible.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the A1 amendment.
Representative Lanning moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Amendment prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This issue is one that came to me via the Sleepy Eye City Council. They passed a resolution encouraging me to present this bill. I looked through it, thought that it had some merit, but it did not have a referendum as part of the bill, so before I authored it, I requested that a referendum be added. The original language that was added was a reverse referendum, and the A1 amendment that you have before you this morning is a straight-up referendum, so the voters of the community of Sleepy Eye would have a chance to vote up or down on whether they wanted to adopt this proposal. The amendment also deletes some of the language in the original bill that the city council felt they would never use. The issue really is one of funding the infrastructure of this community, and it brings up the issue of funding infrastructure throughout small communities in greater Minnesota. Small communities have a challenge with limited tax base to fund these projects without putting a huge burden on certain property tax owners. And at this time, I would like to introduce our first testifier, Joanne Schmidt from the Sleepy Eye City Council.
Could you state your name for the tape and then proceed?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joanne Schmidt, council member for the City of Sleepy Eye. I just wanted to say that not many people realize a city and the history we have of being fiscally responsible. I'm proud to be a member of the council and be a part of this past history, but also in the future, to maintain that fiscal responsibility. And we're hoping to do that through this this fund. City of Sleepy Eye currently has the lowest property taxes in Brown County and also among the lowest in our region. We also have the lowest utility costs within Brown County and also among the lowest in our region. And we would like to maintain that for our citizens. I personally do not have a fund set aside for a street improvement when it happens in front of my home. What we would like to do for this, and I'm sure the citizens all over don't have that either, probably none of you do. What we would like to do, though, with this fund is basically set up a fund maintained by the city in order for those future street improvements so that our citizens will not have to have direct assessments of hundreds or thousands of dollars for the improvement of those streets. We currently have the bonds that we're paying on from past street improvements that our citizens are paying for through their property taxes. What we would like to do is once we have those assessments, those bonds paid for through property taxes, to reevaluate where that is, because we will have this, hopefully, this fund in place, and that we will be able to allow those property taxes that we do have in place for paying those bonds off to go back to the citizens of Sleepy Eye. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Any questions of the testifiers? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to, I want to understand the A1 amendment, and maybe this is for Ms. Dyson. My understanding is that House File 1189, this bill, and as well as House File 929 for Representative Root are very similar, just for different cities. And under current law, the street improvement districts can be established unless there is an objection or a request for a referendum. So under the current state laws, wouldn't the referendum be available if there was an objection anyway?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I don't believe there's general law authority for street improvement districts.
At all?
At all.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
There are other types of street improvement authority, but not for districts like this.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Representative Diffin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, it's a curious bill. I'm really interested in page 2, lines 4 through 6. A municipality may establish by ordinance street improvement districts within the boundary of the municipality. That's awfully broad language, right? And I'm wondering, if this were to go into law, what kind of shenanigans could be played with the drawing of a street utility district? I mean, it could be snake-like, it could be round, it could be square. It could be drawn in such a way to capture certain businesses, and we preferred businesses out of the utility. Have you guys thought about that at all, and how general that language is?
Mr. Chairman, we currently have a sewer reconstruction fund that we have established, and it does include the district as we would have the street improvement district. And we are currently also businesses and residents fall within that. And we have seen benefit through that fund and how that fund is established, and we want to mimic that fund with our current, with the street improvement fund. Some of our larger businesses are fall within the city of Sleepy Eye, and they benefit from our sewer fund that we do have, and the fact that they pay much lower costs for that improvement than they would if it was a direct assessment for property taxes. And we would like to, again, mimic what we already have established for our sewer fund within the city of Sleepy Eye, the boundaries of Sleepy Eye, with this also the street improvement.
Mr. Schmidt, Representative Torkelson.
Yes, in response to your question, Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, that's also part of the reasoning behind the referendum. If you would draw a district that negatively impacted a small group of folks, I would guess they would quickly vote it down.
Okay. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Representative Schmidt, for that explanation. I still have a little bit of concern with that section, but I also, Ms. Schmidt, your testimony was that you're looking at being able to save the general taxpayers some dollars, all right? However, as I look through the bill, there is no offset, right? There is no requirement in this bill which says for every dollar that the council raises through this street, through this brand new tax, that there would be a dollar returned to the general property taxpayer. And if that's the goal, then I think it should be plainly stated within the legislation. Otherwise, it simply looks like a way for a local unit of government to get more money.
It does look that way. Mr. Chairman, excuse me.
That's okay.
I do understand that. And at this point in time, with Senator Torkelson, if that is something that, as far as defining, I'm sorry, did I upgrade you?
I think you just promoted them. I think you just promoted them.
Sorry. Representative Torkelson, if that is something that we need to clarify, that we can work on, we're willing to do that. We do, as I said earlier, with this fund going into place, we still do have bumps from previous large street improvements that are still in place. We need to take care of those, and then we do want to give back that money back to the citizens of our community, so that they have that back to put in, basically put into our community through living there, through buying and being a part of our community as any citizen would be.
Representative Kuhn, or about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I understand Representative Scalzi's concern with the last bill and opening the floodgates with design build at the city level. However, we have some examples of design build, and we can see if it works or not. I was going to suggest to Representative Kelly that he put after the Cannon Falls the word pilot project, because we're real big on pilot projects around here. The pilot, a new tax like this, I think would be akin to piloting the shuttle. That's an awful big aircraft we're going to be piloting. And moving forward with an idea like this that is currently unprecedented, I think would really be opening some incredible floodgates. So I have some concerns and will remain concerned.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Torkelson, what we do now, maybe for Councilor Schmidt either, when we do a street improvement project, usually we assess the affected area after the fact on some known parameter, whether it's running street front footage or area of the lot or something like that, and then we have our hearing and so on and so forth. It appears to me at first glance that what we're going to try to do is kind of reverse the process here and collect money up front for street improvements that will come to a district later. Is that kind of what we're doing here?
Ms. Schmidt.
Senator, Chairman.
That's okay.
Yes, it is what we're looking to do. We do have our city manager that is here, and he has the actual information numbers and that, which would probably benefit you as far as more information, more specific information to this. If it may, I'd like to have Mark Kober, our city manager.
Testify, I would like to come forward and talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While he's coming forward, I do have a letter for the committee from the mayor of Sleepy Eye, who was unable to attend today, and I'll have the pages distribute that.
Get that to the pages, we can get it out.
Mr. Chair, if I can expand my question just a little bit to the city manager.
Okay.
Also,
Representative Beard.
Thank you. One another thing I'm thinking about is, I looked as it in a casual quick reading, it's not apparent, but explain the methodology for notifying the property owners of how much we're going to collect. Is it on number of parking places on the property? Is it going to be on running front footage, square footage of the property, and so on and so forth while you're talking about this? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you want to identify yourself for the tape and proceed with that point.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Kober. I'm city manager in Sleepy Eye, and also the members of the committee appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'd like to present some explanation that might answer a few of those questions, and then come back, if I could, to individual questions about this particular district. At the present time, the city of Sleepy Eye does not directly assess street reconstruction. While we can, the tax that was talked about is a new tax. We can directly establish an assessment for properties at the present time. That's within the statute. But it is paid for by property taxes that are presently in place. New areas of development are different. There are streets, those streets would be paid for by the developer or the owner of the property. We're talking about the reconstruction of streets that when they wear out. For 2009, our budget includes approximately $500,000 earmarked for street reconstruction. That's not the maintenance, the snow removal, or street costs, just reconstruction. Of that $500,000, $300,000 will go for projects already completed, but done on borrowing or bond borrowing. Of that $300,000, $127,500 is interest on that debt for 2009. The two sources of revenue used for street reconstruction are LGA and property tax. Both are largely uncontrollable by the city. As you know, the governor has cut in his new budget our LGA over the next 2 years by approximately $400,000. Additionally, taxes have a lid and cannot be raised by the council to make that up, so both sources are unpredictable to us. We think that streets can be rebuilt in a perhaps better way. In 2003, we set up a sewer reconstruction fund that bills everybody $8, $10, or $12 per month based on property size served by the sewer. It's unique in that it is not by volume, but on property served by the sewer. That was established to eliminate direct assessments for residents for sewer main that services their property. It was the reflection of the folks in the 2001 project that asked the council if there could be a new way to do it. Some of those direct assessments at that time were $4,500 per home. That really hurt the average owner, especially the older folks, who asked the council if there was another way. In 2003, the sewer reconstruction fund began. Since then, we have had several street and utility projects that included sewer reconstruction to the tune of about $3 million. Nobody has received a direct assessment on sewer main, and nobody has paid a dime of tax for sewer reconstruction in those projects. It saved the owners over $300,000 in direct bills. The fund paid for work with cash, and the money goes further when there's no debt service to service. We collect the fees every month. They are dedicated for sewer reconstruction work and draw interest. We collect the fees and put it on time. We now have enough in that fund to pay 10% of the remaining sewer main in town. And we have not increased the rate per month for 5 years. And the latest projection is we won't increase it in the next 5 years with the numbers. In short, that works. We think we could build streets this way. Is it expensive? Yes. Is it necessary? Yes. Is it necessary even in an economic downturn? Yes. There's a system that we have for sewer recon work? Yes. It may not be perfect, but I believe it's better than taxing people for the work, sending the taxes off to St. Paul or Brown County, and then hoping to get them back. Another consideration is that under Minnesota tax system, the commercial properties pay a higher rate per 1,000 property values than residential property. With our sewer reconstruction, they are billed by size, not value. We think that's a better way to share the costs. This measure will lower taxes since street recon would be paid for directly as well. Once the old projects are paid for, the need for tax money would be eliminated to rebuild streets. The city is not eligible for transportation revenue with our population under 5,000. There's also no stimulus money available for us on our street rebuilding. Our chief proponent on this theory is the statewide Chamber of Commerce. In the last week, we have circulated a great deal of propaganda to our chamber members without ever once asking the city how we are going to do this particular system. And while our relationship in Sleepy Eye between business and local government is not perfect, it's a very good one. We think we live together and we do business together, and we think that works. We think that lobbying our businesses otherwise is bad business by Big Brother. The best statement that I can make about our local relationship to businesses in Sleepy Eye is to introduce the Executive Director of the Sleepy Eye Chamber of Commerce, who's with us today, Julie Fitz.
If the pages could bring a chair, a couple more chairs up, they could all join the comments. And if you could come forward, Representative Beard, did you get your question answered?
Well, sort of, Mr. Chair. I'm still not exactly sure about how we're going to draw the district. Usually with a street reconstruction project, it's pretty evident that you tore the street up from here to there and redid it. Are we going to do these in chunks? And then is every district going to have the referendum? And what happens if the one in the middle of town says no thank you and the ones on either end do? There's some process things here, I think, that I'd like to be have clarified. Also, the use of the word tax in there. This won't be on the tax base, but somehow this money has to be extracted from someone. Mm-hmm. So are we back to the fee versus tax discussion, or is... I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chair?
Maybe talk that.
And members, that's correct. The district is drawn out basically for the entire city. That's what we did with sewer reconstruction. because while we do have projects that are areas of the community, it really makes sense in our small town to do it all together. The other thing about that, if we chose to cut a district out, we could only do the fee in that particular district. Our proposal with this would be to have a monthly fee based on property size or something of that criteria for everybody, like we do with sewer reconstruction costs.
Representative Beard.
Okay, I'm looking on lines 2.4, 5, and 6, where it seems to indicate there would be multiple ones. I guess that's where I'm catching that vision. Maybe it gives you the flexibility to do multiple districts, and you're indicating that currently the entire town will be one district then. I guess that's what I'm hearing.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Humbert.
I believe that is because larger cities have a breakout in districts, but we really don't have that many square blocks. We would probably make this our stormwater district is the entire community.
Okay, that's enough for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You brought the another testifier up there.
Julie, would you like
to? No.
Right. Just introduce.
I just introduced her.
Right. Oh, you just introduced. Okay.
Yeah.
Would you want to say something or not?
No, not really.
Okay.
My name is Julie Schmidt, Mr. Chair and members. I am the Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce in Sleepy Eye. This week has been a learning process for me, and I have contacted our members in our community. Of course, our members would like to see any way to save money, our big businesses included. And it's important for us through the Chamber to communicate whatever actions to our community. And this has been an important action this last week, and we hope to continue our good relations with the city, and hope this works out for all of our community members, our chamber members, and our community members.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is a question for whoever can answer it. I think this is actually, I thought this is what Representative Beard was asking. That kind of got answered and it kind of didn't. And that is, I don't find any place in the bill itself that specifies by what means these fees would be allocated. And did refer to assessment by size. Generally, I think there's a couple of possibilities there. If we're talking about street improvements, is the size we're talking about frontage, or are we talking about overall size of the parcel that fronts, or it doesn't even need to front, I presume? And are we making any distinction between properties that would front the improvement and presumably have a more direct benefit from that improvement than, say, the property immediately behind it that didn't?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Humbert.
We, in the present system, or in this bill, it demands that we have a hearing to explain how that system would work in Sleepy Eye. And so it hasn't taken shape as to those final details, but in explaining what we do with sewer reconstruction, sewer doesn't wear out from the outside in, it wears out from the it doesn't wear out inside, regardless of the volume. It wears out from the ground outside and the weather. And so in that particular case, even though some properties have large sections of sewer main and others don't, they all share a benefit of the sewer system. And so we let simply by a property size. Now in this particular district, I believe we would establish something with frontage, but also size. We believe we all use the streets, we all use the sewer, and one of the fears is that we would charge more by truck traffic and so forth. We're not sophisticated enough to keep track of that in Sleepy Eye, but properties are served by the street in every case, and so probably a combination of size and frontage.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank Representative Torkelson for bringing this bill forward. I had a bill somewhat like this before, and we pulled it because we didn't have the votes, and it was statewide. And I think that this bill, if we can get some of these other things ironed out, is very important because this is only only applies to one small district. Cities, as far as, and the House analyst can tell me if I'm wrong, cities, as far as I understand it, are able to do, as you've well explained, the sewer and the water enterprise funds. So you put aside money for the rainy day when your sewer collapses. You put aside money for the rainy day when you need improvements to your water. We already are allowed to do that in law. The one thing that's missing is putting aside money for the rainy day when you have to work on the infrastructure of the streets. And cities basically do four things. We provide, cities provide sewer, water, streets, and public safety. That's the bulk of what cities do. And but the one thing that's missing is being allowed to do the small improvements on the street infrastructure because it's not allowed in law. And I think there's people here today that may testify against that, but I tell you, when I look at this bill and I look at the A1 amendment, which even made it even a better bill because it took out lots of things like trails, I can see where people wouldn't want that, sidewalks. There's lots of things in here that people may not have liked. That's all been taken out. We're talking about the streets now. And we want to be able to protect our infrastructure in our cities. And we don't want to have to go to, through the assessment process for a small project because of all the extra costs involved. Then it gets very expensive. That's my take on it. And you may want to speak to that because I think this is a saving of money. And my city that would like to do this as well has said to me, you know, if we could just put aside a little money, like any of us are doing our families, we put a little money in our savings account for a rainy day. In the meantime, we're accruing a little bit of interest on that, which today isn't much, but we are accruing a little bit of interest. So if the time comes when we need to repair something that needs repair, we've got that money saved. It's not like we have to go out and borrow money. This is a way to save money for to protect the infrastructure.
And if you keep it short, I got some more questioners, and we also have other people that want to testify on the bill.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And to remember, thank you. We do put that money aside in a rainy day fund, which builds dollar cost averages, and actually we're ahead of schedule with that fund. That reflects some direct savings, and there's no interest cost on sewer reconstruction.
Okay, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to build on Representative Scalzi's point and welcome you, Representative Torkelson, to that great club of people who have carried this kind of legislation. I think we're doubling our numbers now. We're going from 2 to 4 today. So, and I just wanted to call attention to a statement in the mayor of Sleepy Eye's letter. He says that this will allow us to change the way business has been done in the past in a positive, more proactive way. And I think that really summarizes why this kind of legislation is needed. This whole transportation funding regime is changing. It's rapidly changing. And it's not just that local units of government don't access our big ticket item, the gas tax, but we're moving possibly to more mileage-based fees. And, Representative Vissen said it. I mean, maybe I view this as positive. I know Representative Vissen may not view it that way, but he was right. This is a way for a local unit of government to get more money. And local units of government need more money. Mm-hmm. We have LGA cuts. We have other pressures that local governments, large and small, are under. And I think this is a creative and, again, as the mayor said, proactive way to address our funding needs for local roads. And so I think we need to look at it as a way to look at this whole funding scheme in the broader sense and the changes that are happening and are going to continue to happen. So I support your bill. I appreciate it. And I think, members, let's keep in mind that we're part of a real changing environment here, and we have to adapt or else cities large and small are going to get left behind.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein built on Representative Scalzi's argument. Now I'm going to chip away, if you don't mind.
I would expect nothing.
Mayor, Representative Hornstein said local units of government need more money. Well, folks, we're in an economic downturn of huge proportions. Sure, local units of government could use more money. All right? But I'm telling you, so could families. So could individuals, so could families. And you said, well, we're just going to tax the business. Well, business has no money. That money belongs to families, and it belongs to workers. And what we're looking at is increasing taxes upon these people. What was in the Scalzi made the argument that made it sound like without a street improvement tax, we don't have money to improve streets. I wonder what's been going on for the last 100 years. Right? The bottom line is that local units of government have the tools necessary to collect the resources to improve streets. It's called the general property tax. Local units of government have the tools to collect the money in advance and not create the debt. It's called reserves. And so with good planning, with building up your reserves, with moving forward in a thoughtful way, streets have been improved for 100 years without this brand new tax. However, now people are tightening their belts, and local units of government have to tighten their belts. Well, it's hard. I understand it's hard. So let's make it easier, and let's look for a new way for them to collect revenue. Fine. But who are you collecting revenue from, and how are they doing? And those are the things I think we really, really need to keep in mind.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to Ms. Schmidt from the chamber, the local chamber. And you don't have to answer the question, although you show up at a legislative hearing and you never know what might happen to you. I guess the question is, does the local chamber support this bill?
Mr. Chair, members.
Mr. Schmidt.
I did poll a majority of our members, and there were a majority of our members and large businesses that did support this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Ms. Brian, Representative Winkler.
Members, we're talking about a new tool. We often talk about the importance of local control and talk about the importance of having, in fact, I think it was Representative Viskins talked about lots of different laboratories of people trying new things. We have two bills that may come out differently, but both of which are going to try to do this. It's not a statewide change. And here we have a case where the local chamber and the local city think they want to do what's going to work best for their community, and it seems fairly presumptuous of us to worry more about the expenses than the people involved. So I certainly don't see why we wouldn't let somebody try something new and try to see if there's a better way for them to improve their city.
Okay, thank you. I've got some opposition here. Jack Corner, would like to come down and speak. You can stay there. You can stay there, Representative Torkelson. Thank you. Identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jack Horner. I'm representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Chairman, we do have serious concerns about this bill, but I do want to say at the very beginning that we obviously, I hope it's obvious, that none of us who are opposed to this bill have anything other than the greatest regard for Sleepy Eye and hope for its prosperity and success. The unfortunate problem is that they have chosen to incorporate a technique or a method or a type of new taxation that has been repeatedly turned down by the legislature for good reason. It's a bill that we have repeatedly opposed. We've got a long history of opposing, so we don't feel that we're coming on to something at the last minute. We believe that a unfortunate bill, an idea, has been adopted that we've long opposed and that the legislature has turned down many times, almost yearly, for very good reason, which I'll go into a little bit. The Sleepy Eye bill is essentially the same as all the other bills that have been turned down. Now, there are some differences, I agree, and it is narrowed a little bit, and I acknowledge all of that, but it is essentially the same bill that has been turned down, and I'd like to go into that just for a few minutes here.
If you can be concise.
I will, thank you.
Other bills, and we've got other testifiers that like to give an up,
Chairman.
essentially what the bill does is it asks the legislature to sign a blank check. They cannot tell you how much money they need, how long the district would last, how it would be taxed, even what kind of a theory it would be taxed under. They're just saying, sign this blank check and let us go about our own way of doing things. They say that this is something sort of like sewers, but it's not at all like sewers, Mr. Chairman and members. Under sewers, you've got state regulation and direction. You charge for sewers annually. You budget for sewers annually. Those costs that can be assessed because they fit the benefit test are assessed to those properties. General maintenance is put on the budget. The current way of doing streets, the current way under the property tax system, is much more similar to sewers than is this new program. The new bill, this bill, allows the city to create literally any kind of a property tax system, any kind. Measuring trips has been mentioned. Sleepy Eye says that they probably wouldn't do it that way. Maybe they would put it on value. What value? We don't know. Taxable value, estimated value, referendum value. Maybe it's front footage. Maybe it's size of the property. Maybe it's something else. The fear, for example, in the multi-housing industry is that this can easily be made to require multifamily and business properties to pay a disproportionate share. After all, the testimony that you heard said, we have a fund now, we tax our citizens now, but we want to return that money to the citizens. We want to build a new fund, apparently without the homeowners, or at least that's the implication, because they clearly said, we want to return this money to the homeowners, to the citizens. I don't know where they're going to get it. Well, I suppose they're going to get it for multifamily and business properties. I mean, what else is there? And so it allows them to create totally out of whole cloth, not only the district of any size or configuration, include whatever properties they want, but to create a tax system of any kind. The bill has two words, regulating the tax, and it is a tax. They call it a fee, I know, in the bill, but it has no characteristics of a fee. It has every characteristic of a tax. And so they create this new tax in whatever way they want. The bill has two words directing how the new tax would be created. Uniform basis, whatever that turns out to mean. The state property tax code has almost 200 pages. Over the years, agreed to bipartisanly with important provisions in them. Would the new Sleepy Eye tax have a different tax rate for small businesses and large businesses? I don't know. Nobody knows. From my perspective, there's an assisted housing building in Sleepy Eye. A lot of concerns. The assisted housing is restricted by rent, restricted to income, rents to low-income people. And in return for that, the state gives a 40% property tax break. The state thought that was important to preserve and to generate affordable housing. Would that be in the new bill? I don't know. Nobody knows. It is a totally brand new tax, totally at the will or whatever of the city. And that is our fear. Just a couple more points, Mr. Sherman. And first of all, brought out to the members, the district has no end date at all. It goes forever. It could go forever. The city is required to come up with an estimate every 5 years. Now, they're not bound to it. This is not budgeting. When the people vote, they really don't know what they're voting on because there's no budget necessary, like ordinarily. And the state process and property taxes has very specific requirements for a budgeting process. No budgeting, an estimate. When a property tax owner comes back a couple years later and says, holy cow, my tax has doubled. What is this? What's going on? Well, the obvious response is, I'm sorry, estimating is not an exact science. Every 5 years they come up with an estimate. That's it. And it goes forever. There's no limit. No benefit test whatsoever. No need whatsoever to show any benefit to any property tax owner. In essence, maybe not intended, but in essence, it's clearly an end run around well-established law requiring the showing of benefit to properties that, in fact, are benefit.
Mr. Chairman, as you can see, I go on, but I'm getting the signal I did not, so I won't. I wanted to respond to some of these concerns. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. And Jeremy Esteson? If you could identify yourself for the tape and who you're representing.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Jeremy Esteson with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here today in opposition to House File 1189. And I just want to start out by saying that the Minnesota Chamber never likes to disagree with local chambers. And the point is that for the last 10 years or so, our members statewide have been opposing this tool for a variety of reasons, especially ones that Mr. Horner went through. But I want to make a couple of points, though. Last year, Minnesota Chamber did kind of a risky thing, and we supported a highway funding bill that put $500 and some million into local roads. We lost members because of it. We went against the governor, and, you know, there were costs. But we decided that because of the benefits, investing in our infrastructure, it was worth that cost. The other point that I want to make is that this tax doesn't just affect businesses. It affects homeowners. And we've seen that folks trying to stay in their houses don't have it any easier than folks trying to keep their businesses running and keeping people at work. In fact, between December and the end of February, just over 2 million jobs were lost across the United States. Businesses are focused right now on keeping people at work. The last point I want to make is that when businesses decide to locate in the community, they do so based on a set of costs that they understand. Well, this bill, House File 1189, changes those costs. Now, a referendum might help, but businesses don't vote, and business owners don't necessarily live in the district. So with that, Mr. Chair, I just want to conclude by saying that that this bill doesn't demonstrate that businesses will save money. The tool isn't laid out specifically in statute, and we would ask members to oppose House File 1189.
Is there any questions for the testifier? Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Essenson, not a question, but just a comment that my concern is actually that the businesses would be drawn, that the district could be drawn to target businesses specifically, and that while the property tax overall, and any kind of, I mean, this is in essence a weird extra levy fee or tax, that taxing business ends up being extremely regressive because it gets passed on to customers and something that, and the price of goods, and something that I've been trying to get my fellow Democrats around is that perhaps the way to make our system a little more progressive is actually to be careful about what we do with property tax related to, especially to commercial and industrial property. So I just want to thank you for raising that concern.
And Mr. Chair, I would just say that somewhat anecdotally, other states who have this tool have been seen to charge businesses disproportionately higher rates. And I heard the city manager say that he doesn't think there would be a trip component, and that maybe gives us even greater pause that there is no established system inside of the bill to take care of the fee.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Essenson, if most of the businesses in Sleepy Eye would support it and want to do this because they think it would be good for business or good for their community or good for any other reason, why would the legislature or the chamber, state chamber, say no, you can't do that? Especially since it's subject to a local referendum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, we're just basing that on about 10 years worth of discussion where this tool has been looked at in a variety of ways. And of course, we have a policy development process we use. We have a transportation policy committee, the same committee that decided to go ahead with supporting the transportation bill last year. This tool, for the reasons Representative Cannon pointed out and the reasons Representative Diskins pointed out, has just been one that we've wanted to avoid.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson? Buzz Anderson? Identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in opposition to House File 1189. This bill has an eerie resemblance to the bills that we've been opposed to, the street improvement tax, the street utilities tax, that we've been fighting over the last 10 years, and that's our biggest concern. And although the city manager did mention that they don't intend to do a mileage-based tax or a customer-based tax, there is nothing in the bill that prevents that. And that's what we've seen happen in other states.
Now, many of the businesses in every community are retailers, and they're the same retailers that make investments in your community in brick and mortar to create really nice facilities and, in fact, increase the value of your community. They pay property taxes, however, based on that, disproportionately high property taxes in comparison to other taxpayers in the community. So I would ask you to take into consideration that this is going to provide one more tool to add one more tax to businesses that are already highly taxed. Secondly, you should know that, and you probably do know, that these businesses employ many of your friends and neighbors. After all, the Minnesota Department of, I guess it's called Deed now, indicated that retailers are the largest employer segment within the state. So we employ a lot of people. We're happy to do that. Anything that does anything to discourage the number of people that we employ, we think is not good. We think that this bill, in fact, will do that. These businesses also contribute to churches and schools and to other kinds of nonprofits within the community to make it a better place, and they do that voluntarily. They also collect sales taxes for the state of Minnesota, and they do that without receiving a vendor collection allowance, as it's provided in other states to cover their administrative costs. As you know, that goes into the general fund, and it comes back to states in many ways, and to cities in many ways. Now, even though the street utility tax, as in the case of this bill, does allow for a referenda, I would tell you that when it comes to people voting versus businesses voting, businesses don't usually get much of a vote. They're going to be outvoted on this one, and our fear, of course, is that they're going to pay the higher amount of the tax if the district is, in fact, implemented. Now, I would just say in closing, I have the highest regard for Representative Torkelson and the people within CPI, the council, city manager, and all the rest. But again, within the tradition of our having continued to oppose efforts like this to raise taxes, much of which is going to go on retailers, we would respectfully ask you to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Trustee Hilty.
Mr. Chair, this is not a question for Mr. Anderson, but for Representative Torkelson or one of his testifiers. Mr. Chair, members, I think that some of the testimony we just heard does make sense. I tend to agree with Mr. Horner in that this bill, as it is written, does not really specify any way in which these fees, or we'll just call them fees, and that's the preferred term around here, I guess. It doesn't explain how they might be assessed, how they might be determined, and I can understand that there might be differences in how that's done, but since this bill is specific to Sleepy Eye, I would assume that there is some thought about how this would be done. And the thing that really disturbs me is in Subdivision 4, and for the requirements of a referendum, that one of the things that is missing there is any requirement for describing the basis for the assessment. It says they must propose a plan that identifies estimates and costs for the improvements and maintenance, but it doesn't require that they include in the description of the referendum how any of these costs are going to be allocated. I'd feel a lot more comfortable with this, that were at least a requirement of the referendum.
Okay, statement done. Any more questions of the testifier? Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Let's proceed to a vote then.
Mr. Chair, roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Lanny, did you have a question here?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this bill and others like it raise an important public policy question that we need to be addressing. And as indicated by our discussion today, there are some unanswered questions here that obviously need a whole lot more work. The issue here, very simply, is what is the best way, the fairest way, to raise the revenue you need to keep the streets up? And we all know that when they're initially built, cities can set up assessments where property, benefiting property, pays for the construction. We know that cities that are on municipal state aid, and that's not all of them, many cities are not, have some funds there to help construct and improve, reconstruct those streets that are on state aid system. But my city is a state aid city, but most of our streets are not state aid. You know, it's a local funding. We have to find a way to pay for the street improvements. And so the question is, you know, what's the best way to do this? And what's the fairest, what would be offer the greatest transparency here? And if we fund these improvements just simply through the property tax, I think oftentimes they're hidden. It's hard to sort out in the property taxes that are collected for the average citizen to really know how much of it is going to fix up and take care of the streets and in their district. So there's an important public policy issue here. But this bill is not the way to address it, and my objection to the bill, this particular bill, even though I support our looking at this issue in a statewide policy, is that I don't want to start on a road where we take things one city at a time. Those of us who are on the tax committee are kind of fed up to hear with all the individual requests for local option sales taxes. And that's why Chair Lincheski, Chair Mark Wart, and others have said we need not to go down this road. If we were to approve this, we'd have a long list of cities that would be coming before us. I don't think we want to have this testimony rehashed for every city around the state of Minnesota that may think this is one way to do it. So we need to have the discussion on a public policy level, and maybe there are some changes that the League of Cities can work on to address some of the issues that have been raised here today, and let's have the discussion on a statewide policy, and let's not start down a road here of individual cities. And so, Mr. Chairman, as a courtesy to the author, I will renew my motion, but I'm also saying I will vote against the motion.
So Representative Lanning renews his motion, the House file. Excuse me, sorry, I didn't see you. Representative Winkler.
Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you. And to Representative Lanning, it occurs to me that we've had a lot of discussion, I guess. I haven't been privy to it, but it certainly sounds as though we've had 10 years of discussion on this issue. And we don't seem to be any closer to forging a statewide policy on this issue than ever before. And in fact, it seems to me that property taxes are going to be an endless battle, at least have been, both as between the state and the local government units, as well as between local government units, whether it be counties and cities and townships, etc. And that it's the very nature of the very diverse system of local government that we have. I heard recently that while we might be 22nd in population, Minnesota is number 7 in the sheer number of local government units that we have. And I think that is that issue of having to deal with these issues over and over and one by one is partly a product of and we also have the most complicated property tax system in the country too. You can't even hardly find a property tax software system vendor who knows how to do business in Minnesota. We have about 2 ever. And so it's just whatever it is about the culture in our state that says we should do it this way. So I guess I don't put a lot of confidence in the idea that we will someday come to a grand resolution on how these kinds of local jurisdiction and tax increases are going to be dealt with adequately. And if we have a local community that is willing to serve as an example where you have businesses and the local government who want to work together and put together an example of what might work, we ought to allow that, because it seems to me otherwise we'll never, ever get to the point of looking at expanding tools unless we start down a path. I agree with you. Having a long list of local option sales taxes to address every year and to make that subject to the political whims of the legislature rather than the merits of any of the proposals themselves, I think, is unproductive. But when we're just starting with the first one, we're not quite at that Pandora's box level yet. We're just starting. And if we have the discipline to say, let's wait and see how this turns out, then maybe we can learn something and forge a statewide policy based on that example.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. And just to remind people that even though we are in room 200, this is not the tax committee. Room 10, excuse me. We're in room 10. Senator Lanchesse, or Representative Lanchesse, tax committee. I just demoted her also. We are in local government. But again, Representative Lanning renews his motion for House File 1189 to be recommended to pass as amended and to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Operations. Roll call has been requested. Take the roll.
Representative Beard?
Nay.
Representative Fiskins?
No.
Representative Tilkey?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Kalin?
No.
Representative Lanning?
No.
Representative Salzy?
Yes.
Representative Turner?
Yes.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Four ayes, six nays. Not passed. Amendment. The motion does not, or the bill does not pass. The motion does not prevail. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Russellson.
Thank you, Chair.
The next one on the agenda for today is House File 929. Representative Rood.
What did you say?
I said Representative Rood. We were laughing.
Welcome to the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I might remind you that was Representative Torkelson's first bill.
You
brought your treats.
Representative Scalzi, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 929 to pass and be referred to the Committee on Local Government. On Government Operations.
And Representative Scalzi, do you have an amendment also?
Yes, there is an amendment, the DE2 amendment. So moved, Mr. Chair.
The DE2 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. The amendment's been adopted. Proceed to explain your bill, Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be before you today. House File 929 is a local bill that I am bringing forward on behalf of one of the cities that I represent, the City of Minnetonka. As with Representative Torkelson's bill, our City Council unanimously approved a passed a resolution in support of this bill on just recently. This is similar in Representative Torkelson's bill in that it's a pilot project that would allow the City of Minnetonka to establish a municipal street improvement district. There is, as mentioned, a similar proposal that would take this policy statewide, and Representative Hornstein is chairing that bill, I believe. This bill would give us the opportunity to explore this policy change in a more limited fashion. As we have heard, our cities are hurting. All of our cities are experiencing budget cuts, and that is a challenge for them. This is a proposal that is being explored as an option, a tool that they can use to go forward and solve their budget concerns. I want to recognize that there is not unanimity in my community among the businesses for this particular proposal. And I learned yesterday that they are having discussions, and I applaud that. I met with representatives of the business community recently, and we discussed this bill. And one of four, I think, as Representative Hornsby mentioned, who has carried a proposal like this forward, well, you put it out there and you get a lot of feedback right away. It is controversial, and I recognize that. But I also think this is the place, this is the space where we have the public policy discussion on this particular topic. And I think it is important that we shine sunlight on it, and that we hear what the opponents have to say, and we hear the arguments for and against this particular idea. I will keep my comments brief because I do have the city engineer here today, Mr. Lee Gustafson. My city manager was supposed to be here, but he had a family emergency and was unable to attend the hearing today. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Representative Rube.
You want to identify yourself for the tape and then
yes, Mr. Nelson. My name is Lee Gustafson. I'm the city engineer for the city of Minnetonka. The bill before you is uniquely different than what you just discussed. It's very specific, and I'll highlight some of the huge stimulus effects that it entails. This legislation will provide a funding mechanism to pay for the local share of what we're referring to as the Highway 169 and Brand Road interchange, and I believe you all have a copy of that colored layout in front of you. In future years, this will be used to pay for other street improvements. This could be with regards to road widening, additional lanes, and other things associated with redevelopment. I would like to point out that this, you'll likely hear that this bill could be just referred to as the United Health Group bill, because essentially United Health Group cannot expand right now until these interchange improvements are put in place. And so it's just not an interchange improvement bill. It's just not a United Health Group bill. It's a bill to make certain that we can revitalize and rejuvenate the whole OPUS area within the city of Minnetonka. The planned business expansion for United Health Group, or frankly any planned business expansion within the OPUS area, cannot take place without this interchange that's proposed for Highway 169 and Brand Road. This interchange would create 900 construction and 850 indirect jobs. 800 new high-quality permanent jobs would come to Minnetonka through United Health Group. And in the future, 2,200 jobs. This would be additional jobs in addition to the 1,800 jobs. And the businesses that would, actually these improvements would benefit the businesses that wish to expand. That's why this is more of a transparent financing mechanism. Street improvement will be funded with fees that is similar to how businesses pay for stormwater and water and sewer. And normal property tax, I want to point out that normal property taxes would continue to pay for maintenance in this area. This legislation is just for improvements that would be help benefit redevelopment and expansion of the OPUS area. Also, that I'll note more in the legislation that this bill does not impact residential units at all. Residential units are excluded from this bill. So simply, this helps the businesses that are within the OPUS area. It allows them to expand and continue to grow. With regards to fees, you had a lot of discussion on fees earlier. Since this bill just addresses the businesses of the OPUS area, it's the city's intent that we would collaborate with the businesses to develop a very fair mechanism for assigning the fees. These could be done on a variety of different ways, on value, on proximity to the various improvements. But we would work with businesses and develop a very collaborative approach to developing the fee structure for this. I would like to thank MnDOT and D. They've been very helpful working with us on the 169 and Brent Road interchange. They've actually identified some state and federal grants which we're hopeful will cover about one-half to three-fourths of this $20 million project cost. Special assessments, you had a lot of discussion about special assessments on the earlier legislation. Especially assessing an interchange project, which you see in front of you, is probably impossible. How do you assign benefit to an interchange project? And it's more related to, it's obvious you can imagine, it's more related to being able to build additional capacity into that interchange to allow business to expand. Special assessments, as you know, can only be based on increases in property value, and trying to justify increases on property value on an interchange is, once again, extremely difficult, if not impossible. Also, that this this special, this area, I'll note, as I just briefly highlighted some portions of the legislation, is just earmarked for the OPIS area. Our district is just defined by the OPIS area. So only the businesses within this area would be impacted by this legislation, and those businesses would also be allowed to redevelop. It does not affect the small business owners 3 to 4 miles away, or all the many senior citizens that we have living with Minnetonka. It just affects and the ability for the OPIS area business to expand. Obviously, you heard some opposition with regard to the last legislation. I'm assuming, I'd be surprised if you didn't hear the same comments with regard to this legislation. But keep in mind, this is just strictly limited to this area. And improvements that will be built with this legislation are needed so the businesses in OPIS area can expand. Comment was made with regards to the transportation bill that was last passed last year. Many people supported it. Many cities supported it. As you heard, the state organization supported it. Minnetonka does get some state aid, and I appreciate the comments that were brought up with regards to where state aid monies can be used. In all cities, they can only be used on 20% of the roads. In Minnetonka, that's just one or two roads. And within the OPIS area, most of the roads within the OPIS area don't qualify for any state money. And the little bit of money we did get for the transportation bill simply goes to pay our local share on the many county road projects and state projects within our city. So my point on that is the state aid dollars we do receive many times just goes to pay our local share on state and county roads. So we don't have that ability, even though there was a big transportation bill passed, and everybody is grateful for that. The local communities and Minnetonka specifically, we don't have any money coming from that transportation bill that really can apply towards OPIS area or apply towards this improvement. With regard to legislation that's before you, I just want to point out a couple things. I did mention that residential property is excluded from this bill. There is residential property within the OPIS area, but they would be excluded for any fees. So it would just be applied to the businesses that and within the OPIS area. And these are the properties that want to redevelop and expand. We also have several large businesses, one United Health Group and OPIS Corporation, that are supporting this bill because, frankly, they cannot expand unless something happens at this interchange. I want to really stress that one other point, and I mentioned earlier, is that our bill does not allow us to pay for any maintenance of the streets within the OPIS area. It's just for new improvements. So we have to use our general tax dollars to pay for any maintenance within the OPIS area. Also, you'll see under Subdivision 2, the district is very defined. It defines a district, one district, and it's just the OPIS area. The streets that you see within that Subdivision 2 establishment of district defines OPIS district. And once again, our legislation would not include any fees for residential property. It states under adoption of plan, suggestions we've received from different businesses and our chamber, we've taken our notification from, I think it was 10 or 15 days initially, to 60 days on many things, and I think even on some things even have increased further than that. And last point, Chair Nelson, is that we do have an end date in our bill. The very last page includes, it states it expires within 30 years. And we put that in there based on some suggestions we received from our local businesses. With that, Chair Nelson and committee members, I'll wrap it up and be open to any questions that you may have.
Okay. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about the 30-year thing. If this is intended for a single project and single improvement, why does the district have to stay in effect for 30 years? It seems to me that you must be intending to complete the project sooner than that.
Chair Nelson, Representative, for several reasons. One, this legislation is not being proposed just for one project. One project is needed to allow the first phase of redevelopment. There's other projects that are needed for redevelopment that will occur in the future. That's why we selected 30 years. Also, 30 years allows a project like this, which is $20 million, the cost to be spread out much further versus requiring businesses to pay over a shorter time period like 10 years.
Representative Hilton. Mm-hmm. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Gustafson. I have the same problem with the proposal that I did with Representative Torkelson, but I have an even greater concern here, and I haven't resolved, and maybe Representative Hornstein or Representative Beard, and you, Mr. Chair, who serve on transportation committees, I hope I'm not overlooking anyone else, can catch if I'm missing something here, but we have a project in my community that I think all of you all have been on the transportation committee with me last term. I've heard me say too often the North Branch Bridge. Minnesota, what's that?
Ad nauseum.
Ad nauseum. But Chisago County is the 8th county in the 7-county metro region for MnDOT. We compete, even though we're in greater Minnesota, we compete with projects like this interchange. The project has been scheduled to not be let until 2014 until we passed the transportation bill last year, but the community still is being forced to consider. I believe that we've been able to set it aside for now. Doing anticipatory bonding to pay for the interest of doing the project earlier of $4.5 million on the property taxes. So now we're talking about going outside the property tax system with the street improvement district and then allowing, using that as a means to allow projects to leap through the SIP, through the State Transportation Improvement Project list, become eligible earlier at a greater expense to the Devil's Triangle project or the North Branch Bridge or something in Representative Beard's district or on the East Metro, you know, whatever the next 35W bridge is, where the state funding, transportation funding system is still not keeping up even though we passed the bill last year. I'm wondering if I have that right, and I'm also wondering, Mr. Gustafson, if you, because you probably are fairly familiar with the TAB and the ATP process and the SIP, so I'm wondering if I have that right as well, and if we're adding a tool that allows communities to essentially leapfrog through a street improvement district.
Mr. Gustafson.
Chair Nelson, Representative, I don't think we're adding a tool that would allow us to leapfrog. This project is not within any SIP. It's not on anybody's radar screen right now. Because it was not known until United Health Group came to the city with a master plan. And through a series of transportation studies, we determined that they could do phase one, but they can't do phase two because of this limited interchange capacity. And so we look at this as more of a, as I've already mentioned, I won't beat a dead horse, but it's really benefiting the people that want to redevelop, the owner businesses that want to redevelop, and different from bonding. Bonding would affect everybody within Minnetonka. If we bonded, we couldn't just have the people within this district pay for the bond. We'd have to the mom and pop grocery stores, the mom and pop little places down in our Minnetonka Mills area would have to pay for the bonds that would go to pay for this project. That's why we think this is more fair. It benefits the people in the Opus area.
Mr. Chair, just a
quick
follow-up.
Move it along. We've got other people who got questions, and we keep our answers short because we've got other people, and we also have people that would like to speak in opposition.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Gustafson, I think you actually just went to the crux of my opposition or my concern about street improvement districts, is that we are going more and more to wanting to see everything and see every single thing line by line by line, which is important in the budgeting process, but I think at some point we do things as a community. But I just a quick question for you. This is not about sort of catching in a gotcha. I'm just curious. You do list on your handout that MnDOT and DEET are working closely to identify available state funds up to $20 million for the interchange. If it's not in the SIP, how is that happening?
Chair Nelson and Representative, DEET and MnDOT are helping us look at all the different funding sources that any city can apply for. There's different DEET applications that that's the $1 million here, $1 million there. They're helping us become aware of those potential funding sources. They do not have $20 million for it. They have a few places that we can apply for money. DEED has, I think, it's a couple of $1 million sources. MnDOT is looking to see if there's some other potential sources. But Minnetonka had a minimum, has to come up with a minimum $5 million. That's our local share. And we do not have $5 million to put towards this project. And the Street Improvement District would generate the local share, the $5 million, to pay for our share of this interchange project.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Mr. Gustafson, does Minnetonka currently receive any local government aid from the state of Minnesota?
No.
And Mr. Chair, does Minnetonka, have they in the past, like my cities, the next layer down of aid from the state, the market value homestead credit, has yours been cut in 5 out of the last 7 years like mine has been?
Yes.
And I guess what I'm thinking is that, so we need this interchange for United Health. So in other words, or not United Health?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I had a
Representative Rudy.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. I just want to correct. This is a bill that's being brought forward by the city of Minnetonka. So I just want to clarify that for the record.
Thank you for that. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is going to assist job creation for this area and is being proposed by the city of Minnetonka to assist this area. But in order to do this project, if you can't do the street improvement district, or this, not a street improvement district, I'm not sure what it's called, some type of improvement district, then all of the taxpayers in Minnetonka are going to have to pay for it.
That's correct.
And it appears to me, Mr. Chair, that this is definitely raising the property taxes for the city of Minnetonka. And frankly, I don't like to raise property taxes. And it feels to me like if there's a reason we can use a user fee, I have no problem with user fees, because a tax is something that we say benefits everybody in the whole city. I don't see that this is benefiting everybody in the whole city. To me, this is a real user fee. Much like we've done in many other cases in the state. And as we balance our budget, we're going to be using a lot of user fees this year. And that's how we do it, because a fee is applicable to a certain part of the community, not necessarily the whole community. We don't want to have small mom-and-pop grocery store 4 or 5 miles away paying for this interchange in higher property taxes. I think somewhere along the line, we've got to try to stem the flow of property tax dollars funding projects and improvements for particular areas.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just coincidentally going after Representative Scalzi again, because the street utility officers have to stick together. She raised really good points that I just want to build on. I think that, in a way, I think Representative Kalin made the case for this bill, because you do have a very long list of unmet needs. Interchanges are among many of them that we see in the Transportation Committee. And, you know, the gas tax is not the future, and raising property taxes certainly shouldn't be the future. And we've got to look at more creative ways to fund things like this. And so, you know, the point is well taken that Representative Kalin made in terms of the growing list of unmet transportation needs in the state, whether they're interchanges, whether they're safety projects on rural roads. We only got to about a third of that with the bill last year. And so there's still, you know, tremendous unmet need in the state. And again, Representative Kalin's right. People are going to have to wait till 2014, 2020, 2030 in some cases as we make our way up this list. This is a way to relieve that pressure. This is a way to give local communities another option, another tool. And I think this is, it just makes a lot of sense to me. And I think this is, again, this is the future of where we need to be going in terms of flexibility and funding transportation projects, large and small, at the local level.
Representative Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. Is looking at the district being very small, but what percentage in your estimation of the assessment would go to Opus and United Healthcare versus other businesses in this very narrow taxing district? I don't want to keep away from the tax that he did, but just looking at a percentage, not a number.
Mr. Gustafson.
Chair Nelson, Representative Turner, you asked for a guess. Is that,
yes.
Okay, this guess. I would say less than 10%, say 10% of the area. I know they do rent some buildings. United Health Group rents another building that isn't owned by them, so that may increase that a little bit, but at least 10%. And they are very close. United Health Group is right next to the interchange.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I love the expression, it's another tool in the toolbox. Well, one person's tool in the toolbox is another person's gun or bullet in the gun. All right. To Representative Scalzi's point about if this district isn't created, all of Minnetonka would have to share in the expense of this new improvement. I wonder then, is there equal safeguards for the improvements that will support 1.5 million square feet of new private development valued at $225 million if those property tax benefits benefit the entire community, or if the property taxes that would be generated in this specific area stay in this specific area ad infinitum?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair,
that was a question. Representative Rosenwinkler, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was following up on Representative Turner. I thought Representative Turner's question is how much of this they expect that UHC and Opus will pay? And I think your answer was how much of the space do they take up? So I'm wondering how much of this do you think that they'll end up paying?
Mr. Gustafson.
Chair, you also represent, maybe I misunderstood the question, but I thought the question was how much space do they occupy in the Opus area?
Mr. Chair, I guess my question is how much would you anticipate that those two businesses would pay of this, the assessment, or the fee?
Chair Nelson, Representative, that would take even a larger guess on my behalf, because what we'd like to do is sit down and collaborate with the businesses. Obviously, if you saw the current United Health Group building and saw Twin One being constructed next to it, their value would be higher. Their proximity to the interchange would be very close. They'd use that interchange. And I would envision United Health Group in this case would pay more of the share than say somebody in the middle of the district.
Representative Winkler.
I'm looking. Mr. Chair, now you've insulted our witness.
Yes. I come over here, yes.
Representative Winkler. Well, Mr. Chair, this is the same bill over again. It seems to me you've got willing payers and willing receivers and willing constructors who all want to do this, and the reason we're saying no is because we have a larger philosophical issue with this concept, even though it's again a local community that wants to do something and local people want to pay for it. I did ask Ms. Dyson as an alternative, though, whether or not the UHD could just write a check to the city of Minnetonka for $5 million and get the interchange paid for, and it turns out they could. So I guess that would be an alternative, that Opus and United Health just decide that they're going to donate a check, which for all we know may be even tax deductible, I don't know, to the city of Minnetonka for that $5 million they need, and away they go.
Mr. Jeff, do you want to comment? Or?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler's comment actually made me even more nervous because I want to just clarify for my good friend, Representative Hornstein, that my concern is actually that projects like this don't clear the deck, they actually add to the deck. They add to the stack. Because it's an example of the communities that have resources being able to find a way to put more on the table earlier rather than actually dealing with the the statewide and the regional needs that we have in our transportation system. It's just a, it is a philosophical discussion we're having because it does depart so much from what our traditional way of defining need and allocating resources around the region, around the state are. I just wanted to really clarify that Representative Weinstein and I do not agree on something.
Representative Beard.
To that point, Mr. Chair, thank you. As I understand, this project is not subject to Met Council or STIP or MnDOT or anything because this is a city project. This MnDOT is only involved because the city bridge actually goes over their highway. To that extent, they're involved. But there's no jumping out of line or anything involved with this project, all because it's entirely a city project.
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gustafson, as I understand, this road improvement or interchange improvement project is intended to help facilitate some economic development, some new business expansion, etc. Has the city looked at doing any portion of this through tax increments?
Mr. Gustafson.
Chair Nelson, Representative. Yes, we have. Actually, this I could have our train development director come up, but this district doesn't lend itself to any tax increment financing. We actually looked at tax abatement. We did a huge study on trying to figure out how to make this happen. And all the conclusions pointed to something like this that would be a more fair mechanism. Because the other, we couldn't do a TIF, and tax abatement didn't really generate any dollars.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You indicated in response to Representative Hilty's question that why the 30 years, that there were other projects that you envisioned. I take it you mean projects other than what's in yellow here, the actual road or bridge project. Is that correct?
Chair Nelson, Representative, that is correct. Just to the left side of that page, that yellow would have to actually at some point in time extend further west. And so those are the type of improvements that we were talking about as future improvements.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, this proposal is certainly different from the one we just heard in some respects. They're also looking at, it seems to me, a much broader range of future projects here, and so on that extent, it's really no different than what we were looking at before. And if we're going to start doing these one at a time, I can assure everyone around this table that we're going to have one city after another, and there'll be no end to these specific proposals coming before us. And it seems to me it's much better public policy if we can deal with these in terms of allowing these kinds of things on a statewide basis so that we don't have to be considering them one at a time.
The opposition Mr. Gustafson.
Chair Nelson, just a quick clarification. This is a MnDOT bridge. Most of that area in yellow is MnDOT right away.
Mm-hmm.
If we waited for MnDOT to do this project, they have bigger fish to fry than just this interchange. So it's considered a city project, but it's all MnDOT right away.
Mr. Sellergren, Phil Larson, Brian Lake, and Kay Rattel, you want to come down and we can get through this in the next 10 to 15 minutes until we can limit our testimony, because we've got another bill we want to get done. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Sellergren, members of the committee. I'm a land development lawyer, and I'm here on behalf of NAIOP, NIOP. I'm the chair of their land use subcommittee of their public policy committee. NIOP is opposing the bill. Kay Racco, our public policy director, will be speaking, is also lined up to speak in opposition. I'm here to only talk about one component, and Kay and the other people will talk about some other issues. I've been doing land development since 1973, and I know that paying for highway interchange improvements is very, very difficult. I also know it's not impossible, because I've done a number of them involving very cooperative exercises from both public and private sectors. They involve very hard choices by both sectors about where to allocate scarce resources. I mean, they really do, and there's a lot of gnashing of teeth, and it's a difficult search. But I want to give you some examples of those which have been successful that have price tags higher than this one. As you know, you have a number of mechanisms available for local government. They're almost always short, and so there's a cobbling together that has to go on that takes time, and it takes persistence, takes a lot of creativity, and people reach into their pockets when they may not necessarily want to. In many instances, it does involve the community maybe using some component of its general fund to pay for a shortfall. Not always. I'm going to give you a few examples. The Tamarack Road I-494 change in Woodbury was a mix of various county, state, MnDOT money along with special assessment. I'm not saying it was easy to create that special assessment district, but it was created, and it was a source of funding. Normandale Boulevard and 84th Street in Bloomington is a very recent example where they have used voluntary contributions from property owners, special assessment, tax abatement, and various other sources of money. County state aid funds. Trunk Highway 52, 53, and Cahill Road in Invergrove Heights, it was a mix of various county and state money and tax increment financing. I may be alerting to various tools that are also unpopular, but they are very much a part of, and they're on the books, and they are used. The Penn Avenue and I-94 interchange in between Richfield and Bloomington, and the new Lindale Bridge along I-94, those costs are being split between Richfield and Bloomington. There's a local share in each, and then there's a mix of MnDOT money, and in the case of Penn Avenue, there was tax increment financing money that went into that. So there are a lot of funding sources available. Not that they are readily available sources. There are special assessments, as we know. We've talked about that. There are voluntary contributions that landowners sometimes do, employers sometimes do, if they're talked to. There's tax increment financing, there's tax abatement, there's municipal state aid, there's county state aid, there's federal money, there's state money, and there's city general funds. Because many of these projects do have some citywide benefit. And then lastly, there's a special services district which has not been used for interchanges but was used to do all the Nicollet Mall major capital improvements. So my point here is that historically, over the last 20 or 30 years, I've just given you an example of seven particular interchange improvements with associated local roads, some county roads, some city roads. Those price tags, some of those range as high as $38 million, higher than what you have in front of you today. So when there has been sufficient recognition of need, And a lot of hard work, oftentimes involving both the public and private sectors, the existing funding sources have proved to be sufficient. They've had to make hard choices, they've had to reach into their wallets, and because of the statewide implications of this bill, NIOP continues to oppose it because they believe that the existing funding sources have proved to be sufficient, although difficult. Thank you.
Joe Larson.
And again, if we could keep it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I will try to cut my comments short. I want to start out by thanking Representative Rood. He's been very gracious in meeting with us and very open to our comments. We do support the development that's been referenced here today. We just don't support the bill in the way that the mechanism is outlined in the bill. We have historically opposed a street improvement fee or street utility fee because, frankly, it's just a new property tax. We have some very big concerns about the way the bill is drafted. Representative Hilty outlined many of these, but I want to clarify. Although the bill is apparently for the 169 Bren Road interchange, nothing in the legislation actually says that. It simply lists a broad array of improvements that can be funded with these new fees, and it's essentially a blank check to the city. The fee doesn't sunset for 30 years, which is a very long time, It clearly is going to be used for more than just this interchange that is necessary for this business expansion, and the bill doesn't prohibit the city from assessing additional fees or taxes within the district. I want to comment about some of the comments the city made about why we need this. Again, the legislation is much more expansive than just what's needed for the interchange for the business expansion. Of course, it's going to support new jobs. We support new jobs, but there could be some loss of jobs from the other businesses that are going to have to pay increased taxes to pay for this. Who will benefit? There's been a lot of talk about, well, the couple of businesses that want this will benefit, and that's why it's a fair and transparent mechanism. We don't think it's fair or transparent. In fact, I think probably 99% of the businesses that are affected by this bill don't even know that it's in existence. Those few members that are also business partnership members that have become aware that are opposed to it because they don't think they're going to benefit from it and they're going to have to pay for it. How would the fees be allocated? Nothing in the legislation outlines how it's going to be allocated. The city says they'll sit down with the business community and figure out a fair method. We haven't seen the city willing to talk to the business community about it so far. We don't know. How will they be apportioned on a uniform basis? The legislation doesn't specify at all how the fees will be assessed or even how they'll be notified. Are they going to go on the property tax statement? Will they go on a utility bill? Will the business get a separate invoice? Is there any opportunity to appeal? The city says they're going to base the fees on trip generation, proximity. Again, nothing in the legislation spells this out. There is absolutely no specificity in the bill about how these fees are going to be assessed, and so we're just sort of assuming that it's all going to get worked out in the end. We also believe there are other ways to fund this project, which, of course, is a very important project. If it's really going to bring in 1,800 jobs, I would think it would run up the list, the priority list, of for state and federal funding. Mr. Selgren mentioned that there are other mechanisms, and I know in the Bloomington case, they didn't even really use the statutory special assessment law. They had the city sit down with the affected property owners, and they worked out an agreement that was mutually beneficial to all the parties, and we would encourage the city to take the same approach for this this project. So, Mr. Chairman, members, we do believe that we can work together with the affected parties to come up with a better solution than what is outlined in this bill before you, and for that reason, we would ask that you oppose it. Thank you.
Brian Lake. And again, if you could, we have another bill we have to get done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brian Lake. I am the Government Affairs Director at the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. As you may know, Twin West represents roughly 1,000 businesses who employ over 30,000 people in the western suburbs. Our footprint includes the city of Minnetonka, and we think Minnetonka is a great city with great leaders, but we disagree with them on this legislation. We are opposed to this bill despite our support for United Health expansion, mainly because of the astonishingly vast taxing power that this bill would create. It doesn't have an assessment formula. It doesn't have a ceiling. This bill is not transparent. It's not targeted. This bill is undefined and unlimited. But the main reason for our opposition is, with the exception of the two corporations that were mentioned, none of our affected members support this legislation. In fact, they are adamantly opposed to it. I surveyed our members who would be affected by this legislation. I explained in neutral terms how the bill works. After giving our members time to digest this information, I asked all of them the same three questions. First, I asked if any of them had heard of this legislation before I told them about it. Not one business had heard of this bill. Next, I asked them, disregarding cost, if they could foresee any benefit whatsoever from having this interchange project completed. Not one business could see any benefit. And finally, I asked them if they supported this bill, and not one business supported it. And for those reasons, we respectfully ask that you oppose this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Layton. Okay, Rackall. To be quick, and
I'll do as quick as I can. My name is Kay Rockwell, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIAP, representing commercial real estate developers, owners, and managers of business properties across the state. Our members are saying every day that they're receiving numerous phone calls from their tenants looking to find ways to reduce their occupancy costs. They're asking to renegotiate leases. They're asking to reduce space. They're just looking for ways to cut expenses, and they're also telling our members that their customers are doing the same thing to them. Their customers are saying, give us the same product, give us the same service, just do it cheaper. So they're going to look at this, they're going to look at this not just as a little fee, they're going to look at this as an additional property tax, as they're already struggling to pay for their occupancy costs and even to meet payroll. As Wellington Management, an owner of one of the office buildings in the park said in a recent letter to Representative Rood, the addition of tax base and jobs is a good thing and adds real estate taxes to the city as well as employment. But another tax is not warranted. We feel this is just another form of tax on property, only with a different name. And I have to tell you that the commercial real estate industry and all of our tenants we support and we rely on and appreciate good transportation infrastructure. And we were supporters of the bill last year that promised $6.6 billion of additional money into pay for accelerating transportation properties and infrastructure across the state. And this money combined with the infusion of federal stimulus dollars, I mean, it's the most money we've had ever in the state of Minnesota to pay for transportation infrastructure such as this interchange. So it's just really, really tough for us to support adding a new tax to pay for transportation needs. Thank you.
Jerry Esterson and Jack Corner. Jeremy? Do you want to speak or make it quick or?
Jack Corner from Minnesota Multi Housing Association. Mr. Chairman, we just reiterate what we had said before with due respect and admiration for the project in the city. This bill is essentially the same, some small differences, but we just renew our opposition before. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions from the members? Anybody else would like to speak in favor of the bill or opposed to the bill? If not, Representative Scalzi renews her motion to have the pass for the bill to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can I just make a quick comment?
Yes,
I will. I just want to say thank you to the members and to the testifiers. I was going to say both for and against. but I do think that it is important that we have this public policy discussion. And should we decide as a state to go forward with this policy statewide, we are going to have to be cognizant of all the criticisms that were stated here today for the record. And I think in the end that will help us craft better policy and hopefully find effective solutions. So thank you for your time, and I hope you'll support my bill.
Mr. Chairman, request a roll call.
Roll call then requested. So again, Representative Scalzi renews her motion for the bill to pass to be referred to government operations. Roll call. What's that?
Representative Beard?
Beard votes nay.
Representative Biskin?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Kalin?
No.
Representative Lanning?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Spooner?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Three, four, four opposed. The bill did not pass. Six. But the bill did not pass. 6-3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1182. Representative Bly. And we have many individuals who have been contacting us about testifying on this bill. And we've got the room till 4 o'clock. So I'd like to get this done before the end of the meeting. So I'd like to divide this up 20 minutes for, 20 minutes again. And I'll give us a chance to have some testimony or some questions and answers, and then we can get this bill voted on today.
So, Representative Biston, do you want to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1181 be recommended passing 82. I'm sorry. Thank you. 1182 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government Operations.
Thank you, Mr. Biston. Representative Biston, and Representative Bly, you can proceed with describing the bill. And
thank you, Chair and committee members. I haven't testified before local government before, and I didn't realize this was such a happening place. I was told when I walked in that my bill would be placed at the back because it would be controversial. And I guess none of the others. Anyway,
but everything becomes controversial.
I'm beginning to get that impression. The bill that I bring before you is the bill that was brought to me by constituents in neighboring legislative districts, and it relates to frustrations that property owners have experienced dealing first with the pipeline that went through their property and now facing another utility moving through their properties with the CapEx 2020 line. And when this was brought to me, I recognized that this is a fundamental question that democracies must deal with, and that is, can we protect the rights of individuals and also balance out the interests of others? So that's the reason for bringing this bill to you. And essentially what it does is it repeals the exemption for public service corporations, and the handout that Deborah Dyson prepared for you, it does explain the list of what's covered under public service corporation, and essentially our utilities and pipeline companies and things like that, and asks that they observe the same eminent domain rules that were established in 2006. So without further ado, I do have some other testifiers, and I'd like them to have a chance to address the issues. If you would introduce yourself to them.
Introduce yourself for the tape and proceed, and if you can keep it concise, that'd be to the better.
Thank you. I suspect you're all getting a bit tired. My name is Rod Crass. I practice law, but I'm not here representing anyone. I do have a history of practicing in the area of condemnation. In the first 20 years or so of my practice, we were located in Scott County in Shakopee, represented six different cities, public utilities there, HRAs, and school districts doing condemnation primarily for condemning authorities. In the last 20 years, I have spent most of my condemnation work representing individuals who are being condemned, although I still do work for some municipal corporations. It was always difficult when I represented cities, as I explained the awesome power of condemnation, when a city could go to a landowner and say, sorry, the public needs your property, your home may be on it, your business may be on it, but we're going to have to take it. And I always encouraged them to follow that up with saying, but we're going to be fair with you. Unfortunately, the statute didn't allow as much fairness as people would have liked. In 2006, however, you made some major changes to the condemnation statute, and you put in some provisions that protected the rights of property owners. You required appraisals before the condemnation was even begun, and you required negotiations in good faith before the condemnation started. You said, don't lowball people. If you do, and the award turns out to be 20% more than you offered, you may get hit with attorney's fees, and if it's 40% more, you will get hit by attorney's fees. You've got to tell the landowner about his ability to challenge the taking. You've got to provide for compensation for losses of going concern. You've got to have a minimum comp for relocation, and in fact up to $50,000 for relocation. We're going to finally give you some money for appraisal fees. You're going to get up to $5,000 for appraisal fees. Minnesota had been at $500 forever. All of these things were excellent, excellent changes that leveled the playing field greatly and gave property owners a feeling like the deck wasn't stacked so much against them. Unfortunately, you included in that statute an exemption for, quote, public service corporations, and that includes all of the big utilities and people like Koch Industries that has put the new pipeline through Scott, Carver, Dakota, McLeod counties as the oil comes down from Canada. And I've represented 55 people in that process, many of them in Scott County, in Mr. Biskin's, Representative Biskin's district. And I would tell you they are exceedingly frustrated and unhappy and wondering why, when the city comes along and condemns an easement for a sewer line, they have rights. When Koch Industry comes along and condemns an easement for a pipeline, those rights go away. And they don't have all of the things occurring that, all those protections that are given to them whenever a governmental entity, starting with the state of Minnesota, through 87 counties, every single city, every single school district, every HRA, all of those condemnations provide for these safeguards and these rights. But when Koch Industries or NSP or Minnegasco comes along, those rights disappear. And I don't understand, and they don't understand, why your rights, your property rights, ought to depend on who takes your property. Those rights ought to be the same for everybody. I will tell you that I have tried, I understand, Mr. Chair, please bear with me, we've been waiting all afternoon too. I have tried many of these condemnation matters, and it hasn't been 20 or 40%, it's been 2 and 3 times the commission has awarded over and above the offer. But what's the incentive for people like Koch Industries to offer a reasonable amount? There's no harm for them. Some people don't understand they don't have to take it, and they do. And other people then are forced to hire an appraiser and an attorney, get a pittance for the appraiser, which never covers the cost, in order to have their rights taken care of. It's time that everyone who condemns under the power you grant in the state of Minnesota condemns with the same property rights and gives property owners the same protections that you give when governments do it.
Representative Beard, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief, and I'll ask the same question of another testifier on the other side of the issue, too. Mr. Kraft, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
A couple years ago, whenever we did the CapEx 2020 bill, well, there were a couple things that happened about that time. The eminent domain reform, and I don't know where that conference committee exception came in for public service corporations. I'm sure we'll hear that here shortly. But then, of course, we did the CapEx 2020 plan because part of the urgency was we have a lot of stuff coming and we need to do some infrastructure improvements. So in your experience in putting these, representing these folks in condemnation proceedings, is the 40% number ending up being a trigger? Because remember, that was one of the things we talked about in committee and on the floor, that if we set that as a threshold, somehow things would magically come in at 41 or 42%, so that it would, if the attorney fees, things would be triggered. Has that been an issue? And secondly, you mentioned people getting 2 and 3 times the original award when they actually did get to go to trial in their case. What percentage of people are actually having to go that far out of the whole scheme of property owners that are being approached to have property taken? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kraft. Mr. Chairman, the 40% is not a trigger at all, and nobody thinks in those terms in these cases because, of course, the trigger doesn't exist. Okay. In other cases I've tried, property owners attempt to get as much money as they can. The condemning authority attempts to keep it as reasonably low as they can. And it is not an issue as far as I have seen one way or another. With regard to how many people have to hire attorneys and appraisers, out of the 1,100 properties that were impacted by the MNCAM pipeline, the Koch pipeline. They have told me, I've talked to their attorneys, and they've told me that they settled probably 900 of them, and a great, great number of those being up north where the property values probably aren't as significant. A lot of the cases down in your neck of the woods have to be tried. We have 22 cases open, I do, in just in Scott County alone. So a lot of those people are trying, are resisting the offers that are being made, but they are restricted. You cannot get a condemnation appraisal, which has to be really two appraisals, one before and one after, for anything close to $500. And for many of these people, the compensation isn't that great. We're talking $20,000, $40,000, and it's very difficult for them to see the way to pay $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 for an appraisal.
Thank you.
Mr. Beard.
Thank you. That's good enough.
Yeah, you'd like to testify?
Yes, I'd like to have Tom Peterson, the Minnesota Farmers Union.
State your name for the record. And
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I'll be very brief. I hadn't intended to testify today, but some of our members have seen this bill coming up and have supported it over the years. Our policy supports strengthening citizens' rights, that strengthens private property rights against the use of eminent domain. And specifically, too, I've heard questions about that Mr. Kress, I believe, just raised about the assessments and going back to look at the property values. I remember standing on the steps of the Capitol in 2006 when this bill was signed and having that hollow feeling in my stomach about the exemption that was in for the utilities. Just because we do have a lot of lines going through the pipelines are big issues with farmers. We do hear a lot of support in the countryside for this. We're not opposed to any of those projects, but we just want to have the same things as Mr. Kress mentioned that are apply to sewers and public projects that would apply to these projects as well. So thank you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Peterson. Anybody opposed? Wait, I'm going to listen switching back and forth so we don't run out of time.
No problem.
I understand you have more they want to speak for, but I want to give the other opposition some time also. Would you identify yourself for the tape? And
Mr. Chairman, I'm Harold Amelin. I'm the chairman of the Minnesota Council of Airports, and I'm also the executive director of the Bemidji Regional Airport Authority. Sometimes there's unintended consequences. When the original exemption was passed, airports were included. Airports are an anomalous type of body. We don't have the ability to move. We don't get to choose our neighbors a lot of times. And with zoning, and Minnesota is a very good example of that, zoning is a very difficult thing for us to do. One of the reasons we were included in the bill was to determine and take us out of that gray area of being an enterprise or a public corporation into the area of being an essential public service so that we could use this tool and continue to use this tool to protect our airports. And I think if you look across the state, airports have not misused the condemnation to do that. We are, unfortunately, frequently caught up in a thing called best and highest use, though, which is one of the things that happened to us before condemnation. When we needed property off the end of the runway for safety or noise abatement, that type of thing, and we went to court, because of a ruling that dates back over 30 years, we were forced to pay the best and highest use of that property. That leaves us in no negotiating position without the ability to condemn that and then use our evaluation to do that and use the appraisals that we get through a condemnation process to come to a reasonable price on that property. So for that reason, the Minnesota Council of Airports and my airport authority is opposed to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Van Loon. Greg Sewell.
Good
you could say your name for the tape and then proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members. My name is Greg Stoll. I live at 3915 345th Street in Denison. I'm only representing myself. I'm just a citizen. I'm here because many of my neighbors in the Warsaw and Stanton and Holden Townships area are very concerned about the CapEx 2020 project, which has been sort of a stealth project for us, which hasn't showed up on the radar screen. I want to bring, I know you're short for time, so I'll summarize my testimony. I have 4 points. I should say, I have kind of a split personality because for the last 10 years, I've been sort of a gentleman farmer on a small farm down that neck of the woods, but I'm also a practicing attorney up in the city. So I'm still learning the difference between hay and straw and those kinds of things, but I'm catching up. The first point I want to make is that a project like CapEx 2020, do you know the difference?
Mr. Chair, just too many jokes to so little time.
Exactly. This project is going to have a huge impact in our rural area. I brought this map just to show you, and it's kind of hard to see, but at least one of these potential lines, just in our one area, cuts across 22 different farms that are owned by different farmers. And that kind of cutting through a farmer's field is extremely disruptive. A lot of these farmers in my area, these are century farms. They've been owned for generations. I love my neighbors, and it's like Lake Wobegon. I mean, these are Norwegian farmers who've been there for generations and generations. One of the big contests, I'm sure you heard about the local vote for our town board recently. It was over whether or not the local vineyard should be able to have people come for entertainment a few times a week. I mean, that was a hugely disruptive influence in our community. And by comparison, CapEx is going to be an incredible industrial project rammed down our throats. So these kinds of utilities have a huge impact. That's my first point. And in that circumstance, you've got to provide us with a level playing field of contesting valuation for the utilities. So point number one. Point number two, you have two grossly unequal contestants in these matters. I don't know how many of you have looked into the certificate of need process that was just completed. I did a little bit, but as an attorney, I was really offended by it, because the utilities have armies of lawyers and armies of consultants, and if a public interest group goes up and wants to contest the certificate of need, they have to raise money at barn dances. I mean, it's really pathetic. And so it was a very unequal process, and this law, if it isn't changed, continues that very unequal process. So unequal contestants, give us a chance. The third thing I would say is, when I talked to an XL representative about this bill, he kind of sloughed it off and said, we usually don't have to do any condemnations because we always give fair offers. And so I would say, hey, if that's the case, then let us get rid of these exemptions, because you don't have to do condemnations because you're fair. What I would suspect is they don't have to do many condemnations because the deck is so stacked against the people who want to fight it that they go to the lawyer and the lawyer says, it's not going to be worth it. By the time you get through paying me and for the appraisal, you're going to lose on the valuation, so take what they offer. So I would say level the playing field if it isn't that big a deal. And the final point I would make is one that Mr. Kraft made before. I find it outrageous that the state and the taxpayers are subject to certain restrictions, and you don't impose the same restrictions on a private utility and their ratepayers. There's no justification for that discrepancy of treatment.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle Johnson. Please proceed and say your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Michelle Johnson. I apologize. I have a cold, so apologize for my voice today. I'm just a landowner. I'm from Denison area also, down south. And I'm just here to represent my family and my neighbors. And I'm a working mom, so took the afternoon off to come and talk to you guys today. But basically, I found out just recently about the whole exemptions with the eminent domain, and I was shocked. I had no idea that this had gone through in 2006. And my family has a small hobby farm, excuse me, and we may be affected by the CapEx when it goes through. We have a possible line that's going to be running right behind our backyard, towards our property line. So but it may affect the health risks with it. It may affect my two small children. We may have to move. So it would affect my family very harshly if we would have to move and would not get fair market value for our property. So that is one of the things I wanted to say. I guess I just rely on our representatives. I feel like you guys are there to help do the right thing for the taxpayers and the homeowners and landowners. And just the way that this bill was put through, it just doesn't seem like, if it's so shocking to most people and most taxpayers, how could it be the right thing? And I guess I don't understand why the utilities don't have to abide by the rules that everyone else does. And I guess those are mostly the points. I know you guys want to cut it short, so those are the points I wanted to make.
Well, thank you, and
thank you.
Thank you for being concise.
Mm-hmm.
Pam Rasmussen? If you want to state your name for the tape. And
I'm Pam Rasmussen. I'm manager of setting of land rights for XL Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in regards to this bill. We understand that the proposal and construction of transmission lines can cause local communities and landowners a great deal of anxiety. Excuse me. The state and its regulatory agencies recognize this as well, and over the years have developed a very thorough and comprehensive permitting and approval process. Typically, as you probably are aware, two major approvals are required from the Minnesota Public Service Commission, a certificate of need and a route permit. The need proceeding examines whether the facilities are necessary, what size, configuration, and time the project should be, and the route permit proceeding determines where it should go. Both of these processes can take between 12 and 24 months. And both of the regulatory process are an abundance of public meetings and hearings to ensure the public has ample opportunity to be involved. And the utilities also have an extensive public involvement process prior to filing those applications. We are aware that some landowners have expressed concern regarding recent linear right-of-way projects. We do not believe the problems resulted from the existing system, and we look to our own experience within the system to support our view. Within the existing legal and regulatory framework, XL Energy has worked very hard to appreciate and address the concerns of landowners and local communities affected by our projects. Historically, our approach has been successful. We typically acquire the vast majority of our easements through direct negotiation during the course of our projects. In cases where we do proceed to condemnation, various protections currently exist for the landowners. For example, in certain circumstances, specifically a project like CapEx 2020, landowners have special rights to require the utility seeking to condemn a transmission line easement to also make a fee purchase of the contiguous property at fair market value, which is called by the farm. We have recently constructed over 185 miles of transmission line in the southwest Minnesota area, affecting 535 landowners. The acquisition process included face-to-face negotiations with each and every landowner. The offers were typically above fair market value, and we also included a signing bonus. Of the 535 landowners affected by the project, only two landowners went through the condemnation process. If the proposed bill had been in place for these projects, things may have been significantly different. First, the project would have been delayed, as we would have had to attempt to comply with the additional statutory requirements of certain timelines to file for the appraisals with landowners. Second, it may have an impact on the cost for our projects. We are a regulated public utility, and as such, our rates are regulated by the PUC. The cost to provide our services, including easement acquisition costs, provides a foundation for our rates. In short, if our cost increases, the rates that our customers pay for electricity and gas will eventually increase as well. XL Energy offers monetary incentives above the typical appraised value of the easement in order to promote goodwill with the landowners and result in successful negotiation. Once we build these projects, they're going to be there for a long time, so we want to be good neighbors to the people that we're affecting. This is supported by the extremely high ratio of our successful negotiations to condemnations. Although our attorneys and appraisers may have received additional revenue if HS 1182 had been in effect, we have not seen any indication that the landowners would have received additional compensation for their easements. The right-of-way acquisition system as it currently in place is both effective and efficient, and that is why we oppose the changes contemplated by HS 1182.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rasmussen, first of all, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Crasby moments ago. Do you see the, of course, you're not, maybe it's not fair because you're not laboring under the 40% rule in this case. So, strike that. Which leads me to my second question. When we did the, I think Representative Jeff Johnson was the lead dog on that bill several years ago, 3 years ago maybe, when we did condemnation reform. First of all, let me just make a statement, folks, that this is 100 years of maybe more of evolving law here dealing with condemnation and public utilities in particular. I'll have more comments on that here in a little bit. But we tightened down for governmental units, but somehow they're for public corporations, public service corporations, there was an exemption put in. Are you familiar with how that happened or why we specifically did it? I remember it happening. I remember there seemed to be a pretty good reason for it, but remember, this escaping me at the moment. But you're with the utility company. Do you happen to recall, or maybe one of the other testifiers coming down, if you could shed light on what happened there and why that point was made, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it was created that way. I do know that some of the issues at the time were regarding entities condemning people for development in certain areas, but other than that, someone else would have to answer the question.
Ms. Dyson recall that, Mr. Chairman? Or
what was that?
Would staff, Ms. Dyson, recall why we did that?
Ms. Dyson?
I'm sure you weren't in the conference committee, but I...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I was in conference committee, but the exemption for the public service corporations took place very early on in the process in the House. And I think, as the witness just said, one of the main impetuses for the eminent domain legislation in 2006 was the Kelo versus City of New London case out of Connecticut, where the outrage was around the use of eminent domain in taking residential properties for economic development, private properties for economic development, and there was a focus on economic development. But the bill, when it was originally presented, it went through several iterations before it was actually introduced, because there were hearings in the interim leading up to session, but it did include public service corporations because it didn't exempt them, so it didn't address them. And then early on in the process in the House, they were exempted, and the I would leave the rationale for that to the authors of the bill to tell you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you. I guess thank you for the explanation. Again, we'll have to wait to hear what the rationale was, and I'm sure it was a good reason. But just to be clear, it's not like they went backwards. Anyone went backwards when the CapEx 2020 bill was passed, or when we altered the condemnation authority, eminent domain authority, because of the Kelo case. What we did was we raised the bar for certain elements but didn't raise the bar for anyone. So public service corporations are continuing to labor under eminent domain statutes that they always have for the last 100 years or however long we've had the PUC around, I'm pretty sure. But more about that here in a little bit.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beard, and I may be off on this, but I think that there was some discussion about eminent domain as it related to that unnecessary coal plant up north, and I think they wanted some exemptions for that. So whether it was part of Jeff Johnson's or not, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Representative Winkler.
I guess the question I would have then, and maybe this is for Ms. Rasmussen, and or I don't know if anybody else can answer, but what principle would be, and what public policy principle would be involved in creating a different standard for building a publicly owned piece of infrastructure versus a utility corporation? I'm just asking the question. I don't know what the principal difference would be.
Representative Beard?
That I do recall, that part of that discussion, Mr. Chair. Because part of what we got into with the real estate, the development was favoring an individual owner over an existing owner and taking someone's property, like we had, well, the Best Buy case was the trigger point for that here. It wasn't just Kelo. This whole pot was boiling because of the actions of Richfield with the Best Buy Corporation and taking out several small businesses and several hundred homes or schools of homes anyhow. That was the trigger point there. I think the perception with the public service corporations is they're held to a very high bar through the certificate of need process and dealing with the regulators at PUC, and are required to perform a broad public service to all comers. They don't get to pick and choose their customers in their service territories. So So in exchange for an exclusive monopoly service territory, they have a high bar they have to meet to serve everyone. There are requirements, however, to make sure that they, in performing that service, they have to have products, whether it's gas, electricity, crude oil, whatever it is. So when they hold themselves out of the PSC, they're required to serve all comers at a certain price, and that requires then that they have to be able to perform certain things. So it's not like it enriches one small group of shareholders at the expense of someone else by taking their property and making them go away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. However, the eminent domain laws that we wrote were not specific to the exchanging of one private property to another private entity. The eminent domain laws that we wrote encompass all eminent domain activities of local units of government. And I don't, for the life of me, Representative Winkler, I know I argued against the PSC exemption at the time. I continue to, because I don't see an appropriate public policy in this exemption.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, are there other testifiers? I'd actually like to wait to hear the rest of the testifiers succinctly, and then
I've got two more testifiers. I think we've got time for, if they can be short. Russell Martin.
Testifiers.
And if you could be concise, because I have one more after you, and then we want to get some discussion on it. And
my name is Russell Martin. I live in Scott County. I was affected by this Mankin pipeline project. I'm in the route for the electric utility project also. The treatment that we received from the Mankin project, and it was geared mostly towards the fact that they weren't required to follow the eminent domain processes. When I got my first offer for the piece of property that we have, it didn't itemize at all how the price was arrived at. It just had a $1 figure on it, and it said, this is it. There was two parts to the process. There was a permanent easement and a temporary easement. And then there should have been something for damages, but it wasn't itemized out, so we have an appraisal problem. The amount seemed to be about 30 to 40% of what it should have been from my calculations. I'm not a real estate person, so I was just grabbing numbers out of the air of relative things that were by our household. I knew that the eminent domain process could be used, so I started reading up on the bill, and I was impressed with the way it was worded until I got to the exemptions part. And it pretty much gutted everything that was put in there for someone like myself. Now, this Mankin project was 300 miles of pipeline. The XL Energy project is over 600. That's 900 miles of people who are going to be affected by these exemptions. The problem with the exemption was that there is no incentive for them to give you a fair and just offer to start with. They can give you any kind of a price they want, and it's in your ballgame, and with the restrictions on the commission fees, the commissioner awardings, your attorney fees, your appraisal fees, your hands are tied. I felt like I was David fighting Goliath, and you guys took the stones away from me. I didn't have anything left.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being concise. And, yeah, over to have it here. Craig Porkin or Porker? If you could be short, then we can have discussion and hopefully get out of here on time.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Porker, and thank you, committee members also, and Representative Bly for seeing us today. My name is Craig Porker. I'm a senior field representative with Great River Energy, and I'm also the routing lead for the CapEx 2020 Brookings County to Hampton Electric Transmission Line Project. For those members who may not be familiar with CapEx 2020, let me just provide a brief explanation. CapEx 2020 is a joint initiative of 11 transmission-owning utilities in Minnesota and surrounding states to expand the electric transmission grid to ensure reliable and affordable service to 2020 and beyond, and to increase generation outlet for renewable energy. The first group of four projects totals about 700 miles of new high-voltage transmission lines. And as the routing lead for CapEx 2020 for the Brookings County to Hampton project, I would like to offer my thoughts on the legislation as proposed. First, I'm well aware that a number of owners, property owners in Scott County and Dakota County had a very negative experience negotiating their easement purchases on the MinCan pipeline project. At many of our CapEx public meetings, I heard firsthand from a number of these landowners about their experiences. As someone who has been in this business for 25 years, I understand their frustration. In fact, it has made our project team work even harder to gain the trust of landowners and local officials as well. To earn their trust, the CapEx utilities have held more than 200 public meetings and presentations in the past 2 years to listen to their concerns and to answer any questions that they may have. We have sent out nearly a 500,000 informational direct mail pieces encouraging public participation in our project over the last 2 years. And we have also formed, I believe, significant relationships with stakeholders who have been involved in the routing process of our project. With Minnesota's 25% renewable energy mandate, the CapEx utilities know we will need to build even more transmission to deliver wind energy from rural areas to population centers. And if we don't do a good job of dealing with our landowners today, and if we don't provide them with fair and equitable compensation for our easements, it will be even more difficult to permit and build additional future transmission in the state. The CapEx utilities have been doing business in Minnesota for more than a century, and we are committed to and have a history of treating landowners affected by our project in a respectful and forthright manner. It's a rare occurrence that you read of an electric transmission utility in Minnesota involved in an eminent domain proceeding, as it is absolutely our last resort. And unlike governmental units such as MnDOT or economic development authorities, electric utilities are subject to substantial regulation, oversight, and process before we are even permitted to use eminent domain. For example, transmission line construction requires utilities to follow a comprehensive and thorough state regulatory process, which involves the filing and approval of a certificate of need, which is roughly a 12 to 18 month process, as well as environmental review, and as well as filing and approval of a route permit application, which is an additional 12 to 18 month process. In addition, utilities cannot take land from one party and give it to another, nor do we purchase deed title like a road authority may. Utility-type acquisitions are almost always by easement and not acquisition of land or buildings, and as a result, landowners continue to own and use their property. Concerning easement acquisition in Minnesota's eminent domain law, probably a primary concern with the proposed legislation may center around appraisals and making them available 60 days prior to filing a condemnation petition. I believe that could significantly change and add time to the CapEx project, as well as to smaller projects in which our distribution co-ops may be involved. When we acquire easements for electric transmission lines, we often visit with landowners multiple times before reaching agreement. Requiring utilities to provide appraisal 60 days prior to filing a petition could extend easement acquisition time, which likely would shorten the time of actual negotiating that we could do with landowners. A 60-day exchange of appraisals could...
We can wrap up.
Okay, almost done. A 60-day exchange of appraisal could require entering eminent domain proceedings even sooner and earlier under present circumstances, and may very well lead to an adversarial relationship with a landowner. Probably a better, rather than a 60-day exchange prior to filing a petition, maybe to file a 60-day exchange, perhaps 60 days prior to a commissioner's hearing. It could very well turn the 90-day quick-take procedure into 150 days. Another concern is how it may affect our distribution cooperatives. They certainly do not have the staff or the budget to handle the eminent domain proceedings. I'm not an expert in eminent domain law, but I do have 25 years experience, again, 11 years with Chisago County Public Works and 14 years for Great River Energy. I think I've been involved in a dozen condemnation cases in that 25 years, and all but two I've been able to settle before they even got to the hearings. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, this issue is one that's
near and dear to my heart, and I have great ambivalence about it because I cut my teeth on the Chisago project, the 230,000 volt power line to go right through the heart of Chisago County, cross the Phoenix St. Clair River into Wisconsin. It was actually my first political engagement. We, as a citizens group, came together and are actually the first, as far as we know, in the history of federal regulation to prove that the line wasn't needed and that it was the wrong electrical solution. But the impact on landowners, you know, I feel for all the landowners that we heard from, because it is an incredible impact, and I think that there are questions that go beyond the NIMBY, not in my backyard concern. I think that the testifiers' lengthy, but as concise as possible, knowing it's an even more difficult and complex subject, I think points to the fact that whether I would ultimately like to see this in law yet, see this exemption taken away, I would like to have that conversation in the Energy Committee, where I think that we need to have a full discussion about planning, siting, and the impact on our ability to meet our needs for the rest of the century and beyond. I did pass a bill last year that will finally require the utilities to provide 90 days notice to local units of government on the routing before they put in a routing application. I wish that it had been certificate of need, a 90-day notice on top of that, because I think that too often communities get asked to have input after determination of the appropriate, of whether a line is appropriate and needed or not. So I'd like to see that included in the conversation, for greater input, but I would like to see this committee move this bill along so that we can have that discussion where we really need to have the down and dirty details talked about.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope we do move this forward also. To hear the testifier and talk about, both from in opposition to this bill, talk about how few condemnations they've done over the years. Well, it's a real life game of chicken. And you got these small families to fund, and you got a huge corporation with all of their lawyers. Who's going to blink? So that's an argument that doesn't hold water. I was here when you did the eminent domain reform to municipalities. The arguments you're hearing now from the public utilities, exactly the arguments you heard from municipalities, it's going to drive up costs. There will be huge delays. Business will grind to a halt. Cities, counties can't possibly work under these new laws we were proposing. Guess what? They do. The sky isn't falling. Again, I will reiterate what I said before. There is no rational public policy for exempting one group while holding governments to a different standard.
Representative Winkler.
Thanks, Nelson.
I was just talking in my ear. Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, and I guess the rationale we've heard is this is a tightly regulated industry, and that you have to go through this lengthy statement of need process. But presumably cities have a fairly strict process that they have to go to, which would be an election, and you have public hearings, and you have to expend public money to do a taking or to acquire land for any other reason. And I guess I don't see the difference. In the case of Best Buy, if that had been a project to build an Xcel Energy headquarters on 494, would the fact that Xcel Energy is heavily regulated have made that taking more justified? I mean, I don't understand why the regulation of the entity that's being able is receiving the wider process requirement, I guess, makes a difference.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think all of us are concerned anytime we hear stories about how citizens, property owners, may have been abused in some way or taken advantage of or run roughshod over. But we need to remember that there are plenty of recourses available at this point in time. Obviously, they may be administrative to PUC or other regulatory agencies. And if we've got some gaps in our laws in terms of protecting people from any public service corporation running roughshod, then let's fill that gap in our statute. But to do this, to go this far, has, I think, some potentially serious implications. Representative Diskins, there is a difference between private entities, private for-profit entities being able to have access to a local unit of government for condemnation, and dealing with public service corporations. And municipalities, Representative Diskins, do own and operate utilities. Mine does. And if we take away this exemption, there's no doubt in my mind that we have the potential of making it more difficult to route needed transmission lines to meet growing demand for additional electricity. That's going to make it more difficult to get the results of renewable energy, wind or whatever, into the marketplace. And that all is going to drive up costs to our customers. And you know, in my community, we're a municipally owned utility. We've got residents living on fixed incomes who can't afford to have their utility costs go up dramatically as a result of making it more costly to be able to build transmission lines, etc. So what I'm saying, folks, is that we need to protect landowners and property rights here, but this isn't the best way to do it, because doing it this way has the potential of driving up costs for our utility customers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lannan, you know, interesting that you're talking about private entities using this tool through public government. Now, private entities don't have this tool. You know that. It was a public government making that decision. We cracked down on the governments, not the private entities. These are exactly the same sky is falling concerns we heard from members who supported cities and counties when we looked to make these changes in previous years. They didn't pan out. I don't think we should be stacking the deck against private property owners. I think that's a fundamental core of this civilization.
Okay, any more questions? Representative Blight, you want to wrap up?
Yes.
And we'll get to a vote. Go ahead, Christy.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and committee members. And thank you for hearing the testimony, both pro and con. And I want to impress upon you that what I bring to you is in trying to protect property owners who have really experienced life-changing experiences going through that, having to deal with the utilities in the way that they have. And you heard from one testifier that it is our responsibility to represent our constituents, and that is what I'm doing coming before you. I think it's an important debate. I thank Representative Kalin for mentioning that it is a debate that we probably should have at the Energy Committee, and I would implore you to move the question on so we can continue the debate and discuss it. I think there are questions about whether or not the certificate of need process and those really do fairly question some of the things that are brought up by these concerns. So I would close by just saying I would hope that you would consider that we can move the bill forward to the next committee. This is only the first committee and many that we'll have to go before, and I don't know what the ultimate outcome would be. And Representative Lannan, you know, if there is a way for us to have a discussion about how we might address those issues without doing this, I'd be more than happy to talk with you about that. But right now, this is the tool that we have, and why I want to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bly. And as this goes forward, I hope the both sides continue pursuing this. And with that, Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that House File 1182 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Operations.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Motion prevails. The bill is passed. And with that, Representative Stern, have you read the minutes?
I read the minutes, and I'd recommend that we pass the minutes.
All those in favor of the discussion, all those in favor of approving the minutes from the previous meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. The motion passed. And with that, we're adjourned.